Welcome, everyone, to today's meeting of the Ocean Protection Council. I call this the third act of a three-part play today. As many in the audience know, our OPC staff work started today with a workshop on the marine protected areas, which will be a central topic for discussion today. That happened this morning, and then transitioned into a so-called fair for lunch, where we got to actually see and hear a little bit more viscerally about the MPAs. And raise your hand if you got to use one of the virtual reality sets to look at our marine protected areas. Pretty amazing. So members of the OPC, if you haven't yet, make sure that you're able to do that. It puts the experience of being in the MPA in a whole new light. We have a busy agenda today, or a crowded agenda, lots to get done. This is the second meeting of the OPC in the Newsom administration. We spent our time in February getting to know each other as commissioners, understanding the groups that track the OPC's work and partner with the OPC, and really get an orientation from staff on the work of the council. Today, really, we roll up our sleeves, literally and figuratively, and approve a whole wide array of investments that will advance the work of the OPC. So we'll jump into it in just a moment, but I'd invite any commissioners to share any opening thoughts if they have them. Good. I'll note that a couple of our members have to leave just a little bit early, and so we'll make sure that we conclude with our voting items before we lose a quorum. So with that, I will turn it over to Deborah to give the executive director's report, and note that we will have public comment on several of the items here today, including items 3, 4, and 5. So as usual, if you are interested in making public comment, please fill out a speaker card, which just helps us conduct the public comment as efficiently as possible. Deborah.
Thank you, Secretary Crowfoot. So we discussed a little bit in February, but I wanted to just take a chance to remind the audience and to remind the council essentially how OPC works. We have three primary tools that we use. One is to convene some of the best and brightest scientists in the world to advise us to ensure that the policies that we're thinking about are premised on the best available information and analysis. We also convene state agencies to ensure that we are all working together in a collaborative and coherent manner so that we are developing policy for the state that is not piecemeal or contradictory. And then we have grant-making abilities to implement the policies and the science-based direction that we're getting from those other two groups, from the scientists and from the agencies. So, today I wanted to start by providing you with an overview of OPC's funding capacity over the next 5 years, and then narrow in a little bit more on our MPA funding and our MPA priorities. So I have some slides. First slide. Great, thank you. Oh, it's behind me. I was looking at this television. I was like, okay, I will look this way. So over the next 5 years, OPC has $127 million to spend on our priority projects, which include climate change, marine protected areas, sustainable fisheries, water quality and plastics, and the sustainable ocean economy. We receive those funds from a variety of sources, including bond funds, the general fund, once through cooling, and a one-time appropriation of environmental license plate funds, which are part of our general fund money. So you can see the distribution here. We get about two-thirds of our funding from, about half of our funding from bonds, and the other half, if you added general fund and ELPF together, that would be another third, and then we get once through cooling funds. And this is over 5 years. So if you can go to the next slide. These are OPC's funding priorities based on our existing strategic plan and looking forward at the draft strategic plan that we'll be discussing in a little while. And you can see it's fairly evenly split, the funding that we have for among climate, MPAs, and marine ecosystems. And then in addition, we have a little bit of funding for water quality and a little bit of funding for whale entanglement. The whale entanglement funding, I would say, applies most specifically to our sustainable fisheries area. And then the water quality is distributed across the board because we really try to emphasize with those Prop 1 funds, making sure that there are multi-benefits and that they're targeting all of our different program areas. So let's go back to one slide. So the marine ecosystem portion of our funding really supports our work in sustainable fisheries, in water quality and plastics, and to some extent MPAs. And later this afternoon, we'll be asking you for help in approving our guidelines to spend Prop 68 funds, from which we received $35 million for those marine ecosystems and another $21.2 million specifically directed towards climate. As you can see, the funding distribution demonstrates a really significant commitment on the part of the Ocean Protection Council for marine protected areas. And so that's what I'm going to focus on next. So next slide, please. Our marine protected areas, these stunning wilderness areas underwater, protect the diversity and the abundance of California's marine wildlife and the habitats and ecosystems that they thrive in. The goal of our marine protected area network is to ensure that we have a series of refuges across the state, across the entire coast, where ocean creatures can thrive undisturbed, they can reproduce, they can grow, and this will lead to stronger, more resilient marine ecosystems across the state overall. In 2012, California became the first state in the country to complete our marine protected area network of underwater parks. And this network was designed through a public process that we recognized earlier today, and I will acknowledge again here. It included an incredible number of stakeholders, ranging from fishermen, scientists, tribes, business owners, environmentalists, state agencies. Everyone came together, and today we benefit from all of that hard work, and we have 124 ecologically connected marine protected areas up and down the coast. Next slide, please. So to ensure that the MPA network continues to have long-term success, the state is committed to coordinating and collaborating both among our agencies and with all of the stakeholders and all of the folks here in the room today. Three agencies play leading roles in the management of MPAs. We have the Fish and Game Commission, which makes final decisions associated with the management of MPAs. We have the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, which is the lead agency for day-to-day management. And then the Ocean Protection Council. We are designated to be the policy lead for the Marine Protected Area Network. Because California has the first ever network in the country, there are a plethora of scientific and policy questions that we are working to answer to ensure the success and the durability of this network. We all partner together on a daily basis to ensure that that our network is appropriately and adequately protects and conserves marine life and habitat. Next slide. The creation of the MPA network could not have happened without the vision, the commitment, and the financial contributions of the private philanthropic sector. The state's initial investment of $18.5 million for the planning and designation of the network was matched by $19.5 million from the private sector. Our philanthropic partners have continued to invest millions of dollars since the creation of the network to ensure its success, and particularly in the areas of outreach and education. We also benefit from really significant partnership with the federal government. The National Marine Sanctuaries have been a friend and colleagues, and we coordinate on shared messaging and synergistic policy development across the board. Next slide. To date, OPC has invested $53 million in the California Marine Protected Area Network. Our investments span the four broad categories of activities that we have all become quite familiar with when discussing MPAs. So these are the categories that we have determined contribute to MPA success, and they include outreach and education, research and monitoring, enforcement and compliance, and policy and permitting. Today, you'll be hearing from staff bringing forward proposals that address all four of those categories of activities, totaling close to $17 million. In broad strokes, these address, first, long-term research and monitoring to inform the 2022 management review and subsequent decadal reviews, working with our science advisory team to develop scientific guidance that will structure this review and help assess the benefits that the MPA network may provide in the face of climate change. Restoration projects that contribute to the long-term success of the MPA network, outreach and education efforts to communicate with the public about the importance and value of the network, and enforcement efforts to reduce and prosecute unlawful poaching. Next slide. We're starting to document some positive ecological effects of individual MPAs, and for those of you who were at the seminar this morning, you heard from Dr. Cassell and from Dr. Raimondi about some of the positive impacts that we are seeing as a result of MPAs. We know in the Channel Islands that there's been greater fish biomass inside MPAs than outside MPAs. You heard a little bit more about how these marine protected areas can help provide additional resilience, can help enable, you know what, I'm not going to try to paraphrase their excellent work. I will leave it to the scientists to explain what they were talking about, but suffice it to say that we really are beginning to see some very positive and promising results, and they are well respected as potential places of resilience going forward. So, in summary, I just want to note that by funding projects related to science, to communication, and to policy, OPC is making a strong commitment to the continued success of the MPA network, and I look forward to staff presentations. Thank you.
Thanks, Deborah. Before we move to staff presentations, questions among our colleagues? I have one question. If you can toggle back to the map, the statewide map of the MPAs. So if that's possible, I think that's the second or third slide. There it is. In a few sentences, can you just differentiate between the three categories of MPA types that's shown on the map?
Sure, but I think I will actually ask Tova to take that to just make sure that we get all the details in there.
Can you hear me? Hello. Hi, I'm Tova Handelman. I'm the Marine Protected Area Program Manager. The three designation types that you see there, you see in red, there's state marine reserves. That's fully protected. No take is allowed from those areas. Then in blue, you see SMCAs, that's state marine conservation areas. Some take is allowed in those areas, and it's different depending on which conservation area it is. And then you see the purple, which is SMCA's no take. That's conservation areas that don't allow any take. And it's a slightly different designation than a marine reserve, but essentially the same kind of thing.
Thank you. So let's move into the presentations, really in three parts. Mike will present the first set of proposed grants, followed by Tova, followed by Adrian.
All right. You guys hear me? All right. Good afternoon, Chair Crowfoot and members of the council. I'm Mike Escrow. I'm the Marine Ecosystems Program Manager at OPC, and I'm very excited today to be bringing seven long-term MPA monitoring projects to you for your consideration. As you heard from Deborah, MPA management in California is a collaborative effort that involves multiple focal areas. And one of those focal areas is research and monitoring to ensure that our MPA network is meeting the goals set forth in its founding legislation, the Marine Life Protection Act. Phase one of MPA monitoring, baseline monitoring, was conducted at or near the time of MPA implementation across the state, and OPC invested $16 million in that baseline effort. The results from baseline monitoring have provided us with a reference point against which scientists and managers can now begin to measure changes that result from MPA protection. And to that end, the state is now entering phase two of MPA monitoring, which is long-term monitoring. To guide this long-term monitoring phase, the state has developed an MPA monitoring action plan, which lays out priority habitats, sites, species, and metrics to target for long-term monitoring. So essentially, the action plan answers the question, if you want the best chance of detecting an MPA effect, who, what, and where should you monitor? Long-term monitoring obviously is going to be a very critical component of the MPA adaptive management cycle. And in particular, this is very timely because MPA monitoring, long-term monitoring will inform the 2022 management review, which you guys heard about earlier this morning. In early November 2018, California Sea Grant, in cooperation with OPC and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, released a competitive call for $9.5 million to support long-term monitoring projects that would be grounded in the action plan. So taking those targeted things in the action plan and actually getting out in the water and monitoring them. This funding was authorized by OPC in July of 2018 through a $9.5 million grant to Sea Grant. Assuming that you guys approve these projects, Sea Grant will then subgrant to the awardees. And here you see some, I don't know if I have a laser pointer here, yeah, some
scientists
conducting a little bit of, yeah, a little bit of monitoring right there. That's what we do. We get in the water and we monitor white sharks. So first off, I'm going to tell you about four habitat-based ecological monitoring projects. And yes, as you can see here, monitoring in the marine environment comes with some unique challenges. These projects are all collaborative statewide efforts that involve multiple institutions and organizations. So you'll see one grantee listed, but that grantee will be partnering with many other institutions and organizations throughout the state to get this monitoring done. Guided by the action plan, research teams for each of these projects will focus on collecting data both inside and outside MPAs in two field seasons, so summer 2019 and summer 2020, inside and outside so that they can compare. And then they will focus on data analysis and report writing in year three. And I also want to make the point that there were two proposals that came to us through this competitive call that were deemed by the review panel to be more appropriate for another source of funding. That's estuary monitoring and a proposal to advance the use and collection of traditional ecological knowledge in MPA management. Those we'll hopefully be bringing to you later on this year for consideration. So, first habitat-based project, rocky intertidal. California's rocky intertidal habitats, as you heard from Pete this morning, are highly biodiverse. They host a variety of important plants and animals like these ochre stars that you heard about earlier, got hit hard with sea star wasting. The rocky intertidal also provides really important cultural, recreational, and economic benefit to the people of California, but it's very highly threatened. In particular, the rocky intertidal is very susceptible to climate-related impacts. And this vulnerability is really concerning given, again, from what you heard from Pete, the extreme rarity of rocky intertidal habitat in California. So this project will collect both biological and environmental data in rocky intertidal habitats statewide using transects, photo plots, basically standardized survey methods for this environment. And researchers will conduct analyses using both historical and new data to get a sense of what MPAs are doing, what effects MPAs are having on these habitats, again, across the state. Next, we have our kelp forests and our shallow rocky reefs, so anything up to 30 meters of depth. These, as you know, are some of California's most iconic marine ecosystems. They support a variety of ecologically and economically important species, including these rockfish that you see over here, sheephead, and of course, everybody's favorite, otters. Mm-hmm. This otter's that's particularly excited about this, this long-term monitoring. It's giving you two paws up for your great work, guys. Essentially, this project we'll collect data via scuba surveys conducted by both professional and citizen scientist divers, so bring citizen science into this project as well. And continued monitoring of these ecosystems, in addition to informing the MPA review, is going to be very important given the dramatic declines in kelp that we've seen statewide recently. All right. And data analysis here is, again, going to assess trends both inside and outside MPAs across the statewide network. Next, we have deep rocky reef habitats, so things that are deeper than 30 meters depth. These, interestingly, represent at least 75% of all marine habitats in California by area. They support a very high diversity of marine species, including many species that the Department of Fish and Wildlife has determined are likely to benefit from MPA establishment. But they also experience a much greater degree of likelihood of habitat alteration because of the heavy use of fishing gear in this area. They're also relatively understudied just because it's hard to sample in deep water. You need boats, you need expensive equipment like ROVs. So this project represents an opportunity for the state to really build on our understanding of these marine systems, these unique ecosystems that was developed during baseline monitoring, and continue to improve our understanding. So in this project, researchers will conduct ROV and drop camera surveys, again, inside and outside MPAs, collecting biological data and providing a comprehensive assessment of deep reef ecosystem health. Next, we have sandy beaches and surf zones. That picture's for you, Mike Brown, on the left there. Obviously, very important component of recreation in California, be it surfing, surf fishing, just spending a day at the beach. But also, sandy beaches support a variety of very important native species like these endangered snowy plovers that you see here. The interesting thing about sandy beaches is they are directly protected by MPAs. Obviously, there's no take allowed there. But they're also indirectly protected because sandy beaches are tightly linked to offshore donor ecosystems. So changes in the trophic structure offshore can affect how things are doing on the sandy beach. This project will collect biological, again, environmental and geological data in and outside MPAs and sandy beach habitats statewide. So again, analyze those key action plan variables over time. So those are the habitat-based projects. Now I'm going to tell you about three projects that will help us answer some broader questions about MPAs. For example, what is the effect of MPA establishment been on fishing communities? And how are MPAs helping to provide our marine ecosystems with resilience in the face of changing ocean conditions? So first, we have a grant to establish socioeconomic monitoring. Obviously, humans are a very key component of California's nearshore marine ecosystems. Fishing communities, rightly, have expressed some concern about the impact of establishing MPAs on their livelihoods and their recreational opportunities. So this socioeconomic monitoring program will help to ensure that MPAs maximize their ecological benefits while minimizing potential impacts. It'll do that by establishing a monitoring program for two consumptive human uses, commercial fishing, and then CPFV fishing. That stands for commercial passenger fishing vessels, basically party boats, fishing charters. Very important industry in California. EcoTrust, the grantee, will obtain both quantitative data by analyzing commercial landings and CPFV logbooks, as well as qualitative data by going out into each of California's major ports and conducting interviews and focus groups with fishermen, actually on the ground. Next, we have the California Collaborative Fisheries Research Program. It's a diverse partnership of volunteer fishermen, boat captains, scientists, NGOs, all of whom share a common interest in sustainable fisheries and healthy oceans. CCFRP is unique in that it takes volunteer anglers out actually on the water to conduct catch and release hook and line monitoring inside and outside MPAs. So not only do CCFRP surveys provide really important data to the state, they've been doing that since 2007. When MPAs were first established on the North Coast, but they also represent a really cool opportunity to engage the recreational fishing community in MPA monitoring, actually get folks out on the water doing what they love doing and helping to inform the state at the same time. Very cool. And CCFRP, most of the volunteers are fishermen.
What kind of fish is this?
Sorry?
What kind of fish?
All kinds of fish. Those are lingcod. Those are some very big lingcod. And not only fishermen, but also deputy directors of OPC. So there's Jen Eckerly right there with a huge vermilion rockfish that she caught on a trip out at Año Nuevo that day. I caught a fish that was about that big that same day. So Jen won. All right. Very last project. Obviously, California's ocean and coast face a variety of environmental stressors, and it's very hard to tease apart the effect of these stressors from the effect of MPAs, right? So how can scientists and managers understand differences that may be attributable to resource protection versus things that are just changing in the ocean environment more broadly, like variation in dissolved oxygen or pH, sea surface temperatures, nutrients, etc.? So this project will address that question for the very first time in California using using data from the Central and Northern California Ocean Observing System, which is this project that has a variety of assets out in the water collecting all kinds of environmental data, as well as the same network in Southern California. And this project will produce models of change in key environmental indicators at a variety of scales, essentially helping to collect or place all of our other monitoring results in the context of changing ocean conditions. So, brief conclusion, the ocean and the people that rely on it need those of us who are here in Sacramento to make good decisions, and we can't make good decisions without good information. In the case of MPAs, this means scientifically rigorous data, good data collection, good data analysis. These projects accomplish that, and we strongly recommend that you approve them. And they will also contribute to broader state priorities, including climate resiliency and sustainable fisheries. So that's it. I thank you very much for your consideration. You're about to hear some more MPA projects, but I'm happy to take any questions at the end of this agenda item.
Mike, let's entertain questions for each piece just while it's fresh in our minds. Colleagues, questions. Jared.
So thanks for that presentation. I really appreciate it and the depth in which you're going to. In terms of the last slide, which is kind of that we're doing this in order to achieve inputs into adaptive management policy regime, like how is the adaptive management program designed so that so I'll give an example. So let's say that the recreational fishermen, have a benefit, but the commercial fishermen don't. Like how will that data allow us to make real decisions? Because from Deborah's presentation at the beginning of how kind of our responsibility differs from others, it's really around the policy. What I'm hearing a lot is around the research needs, which informs policy, but I'm not seeing the direct connection between the results that we get here and how they directly feed into adaptive management.
Well, that's a really good question, so thank you for that. Essentially, adaptive management is defined in the Marine Life Protection Act Master Plan that was last updated in 2016, says that we take policy actions and then we monitor to see what the results of those policy actions are. And that's why it's a cycle, because then we use the results of that management to directly inform, iterative, continuous improvement of these policy instruments. Like I said, we have our first management review coming up in 2022. So that is going to be the first opportunity for managers, the Fish and Game Commission mainly, but OPC and the department will be obviously directly involved, to look and see what the results of MPA implementation have been over the last 10 years. And so at that point, like Becky was saying earlier this morning, they will have an opportunity to kind of consider if there's any possible changes to policy that should be made. With the caveat that these are temperate ecosystems, and 10 years is not very much time to start to see ecosystem-wide shifts. But 2022 is only the first decadal management review, so we'll go back in 2032 and 2042, which are scary numbers to think about. But we'll go back every 10 years to see, okay, how are these MPAs working? Are they accomplishing those six goals that are set forth in the Marine Life Protection Act? Does that help answer your question?
Yeah, I guess the way that grants are written and under chairmanship of Wade, we'll be here in 2022 in all likelihood. So I just want to make sure that the data that we receive from a significant amount of money going out the door is tied to measurable ways that we can think about adaptive management as opposed to broadly written. So the more specific the grants can be written to tools that help us understand what we need to do in 2022, the better, and the further away, the more complex our job will be.
Right, and that was the point of the action plan as well, just to ensure that the metrics, the sites, the species that we're targeting are going to directly inform adaptive management. So you don't go out there and necessarily count everything you see, for example. You target species that are very important for the state to monitor.
Good, thanks. Mike.
thank you again. Great presentation, Mike. Especially that one.
I thought you'd like that.
So, taking an aspect of Secretary Blumenthal's comment, what are in the data collection? I heard ecological data, geographic, blah, 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 blah. What seems to me to help get at some of these policy issues is additional information about human use. I'll thinking of the snowy plover situation in multiple places. Yeah, people aren't supposed to be there, but they are there. So is that kind of data included in the collection, and how is that going to be analyzed briefly?
Yeah, great question. So the two projects that aren't subtitled, so the Rocky Intertidal and Sandy Beach, both have a human use monitoring component to them. So when folks are out doing Sandy Beach surveys and counting birds, for example, they'll also be observing recreational uses. So those are really going to help us answer that question of, okay, how are folks using these MPAs? Is there disturbance? But also on the flip side of that, are these MPAs providing enhanced recreational benefit, which is one of the goals of the Marine Life Protection Act itself. So we will be monitoring those human uses. There are also projects that you'll hear about, not necessarily later today, but things that we're thinking about through cooling funds, which are gonna directly get at that question as well. Yeah.
Jordan.
Oops, sorry. Thank you, Secretary Kofut. These projects sound terrific. My question would be, in terms of the total amount of information that we need in order to be able to actually effectively review, what percentage of the spectrum of information are we covering with these grants, or what remains to be covered?
That's also a really good question. My training is in ecology, so the answer is always like, let's do more, right? I mean, I think we could always do more. I would consider these to be a subsample. I don't know that I could give you a percentage, but I do know that we're covering the habitats that we need to cover, that these grants are monitoring the species that we need to cover. We're going to the places we need to go to give us the best chance of detecting a signal from all the noise of all those other, like, changing ocean conditions and things I was talking about earlier. So I think that if there's an MPA signal out there, these are the projects that are going to be able to detect it. Again, I don't know that I can think of an exact percentage, but the action plan was written so that, kind of bare bones, because funding capacity is always limited. If you can only go out and monitor these things, this is what you need to look for. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, essentially, more information is always better,
right?
But this is giving us a sampling in all the major areas.
Exactly.
Good. Let's move on to Tova.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Hi, everybody. There we go. For the sake of the record, I'll introduce myself again. I'm Tova Handelman, the Marine Protected Area Program Manager. Today I'm presenting projects from our Once Through Cooling program, and that will be 3B and 3C. So I think if it's okay with you, I'll go through until the end of 3C, and then we can take questions on both items. A little bit of background. Once through cooling technology pulls water from the ocean to cool down power plants, and in doing so, it traps or kills marine life, and then it expels hot, polluted water back into the ocean. OPC receives up to $5.4 million annually from the mitigation payments made by power plants still using once through cooling. These funds support projects that will offset the negative ecological effects and increase marine life associated with MPAs. OPC's Once Through Cooling Mitigation Program prioritizes investing these funds through four categories to ensure effective management of the MPA network. The four priorities, as listed there, are enforcement, research, restoration, and public outreach. The proposed projects in items 3B and 3C are aimed toward the last two priorities, restoration and outreach. In the fall of 2018, we released a competitive solicitation for restoration proposals for up to $3.4 million. Seven proposals were thoroughly considered by an expert review panel, and proposals were mostly centered around wetland or kelp restoration between Big Sur and San Diego, which is the geographic region of the Once Through Cooling facilities. The two proposals I'm presenting for your consideration come recommended by the review panel for their fit with our Once Through Cooling program and their potential for large-scale impact to mitigate the effects of Once Through Cooling and increase marine life associated with MPAs. I do want to mention that a third proposal for restoration of the Los Cerritos wetlands was recommended for funding, but has been removed from today's agenda due to recent questions raised about the project's potential impacts on environmental and cultural resources. We are working with the applicant to understand more before bringing it to the council for recommendation. So the first project is about wetlands in San Diego. San Diego County was once home to more than half of estuarine habitats in the Southern California Bight, but has lost 31% of its wetlands in the past century. This project will grant just over $1 million to Wild Coast to restore 42 acres of degraded wetland habitat around two MPAs in San Diego County, the Batiquitos Lagoon and the San Dieguito Lagoon. Wild Coast will oversee the projects and partner with the Batiquitos Lagoon Foundation and the San Dieguito River Valley Conservancy, which are two organizations that have a long history of successful restoration efforts in the area. The restoration plan includes removing invasive plants and planting over 150 native oak woodland trees and over 200 coastal scrub plants to restore the natural integrity of these wetlands. You can see from the two photos on the left there on the slide how the lagoons currently look and that the proposed restoration is sorely needed. The restoration sites are denoted by yellow stars on the map on the right there. They are positioned on either side of two additional MPAs, that's Suamis and the San Alijo Lagoon. And because the MPA network is designed with ecological connectivity, we anticipate that these two MPAs could gain from the ecosystem benefits brought from this project, such as increased food sources and shelter for marine birds and animals. Wild Coast has included the involvement of city and tribal governments into its restoration plan and will also employ young adults in the Conservation Corps to undertake the restoration efforts. Wild Coast will leverage its ongoing programming to bring students on field trips from nearby disadvantaged communities without direct access to nature to participate in the restoration as well. All right, as we learned from Dr. Pete Raimondi in the MPA workshop this morning, rocky intertidal habitats across California are facing increasing threats from coastal development, especially in the highly populated South Coast. The decline of rockweed has been of particular concern, as rockweed is an important food source to grazers such as the endangered black abalone, and it also serves as a nursery for juvenile fish. This project would grant $1.6 million to UC Santa Barbara in partnership with UCLA, UC Santa Cruz, and Cal Poly Pomona to restore rockweed populations from Big Sur to San Diego, including the Channel Islands. This project is one of the first large-scale restoration efforts in rocky intertidal habitats in California. The plan is to transplant samples from healthy rockweed habitats, denoted there by green circles on the map, to areas in need of restoration, which is marked by red circles. This project aims to target the entire geographic region affected by once through cooling, with five restoration sites between Big Sur and Santa Barbara, five sites from Santa Barbara to San Diego, and then five sites around the Channel Islands. The rockweed will be transplanted onto the rocks with a non-toxic glue. And to monitor the survival and growth of the rockweed, the PIs will use cutting-edge drone technology to map the area. The diverse affiliations of the partners on this project exemplify the cross-regional collaboration required to execute a restoration effort of this size. The PIs will leverage the strong relationships they have created with agencies and stakeholders such as the National Park Service, the U.S. Navy, the local MPA collaboratives, and many more that I don't have time to mention right now because we need to move on to our outreach and education projects. Compliance with MPA regulations is one of the key factors that contributes to the success of the MPA network. Studies of MPAs around the world show that compliance increases when there's a greater awareness of the regulations and when the public has a strong stewardship ethic. In item 3C, we recommend approving funding for three outreach and education projects that will encourage stewardship and compliance of the compliance of MPA regulations to help increase marine life associated with MPAs. The first project will grant $498,000 to the California Marine Sanctuary Foundation to better inform commercial and recreational fishermen about MPA regulations. This project is the continuation of a larger ongoing effort that OPC and CMSF have been working on together since 2017. During phase one, CMSF undertook the colossal effort to perform a needs assessment to identify major gaps in MPA education. They also compiled a MPA resource library, which consolidated many education products into one location. Phase two started in March of this year and aims to address some of the gaps identified in the needs assessment by helping to disseminate information ahead of the summer fishing season. The project for the Council's consideration today is Phase 3, which will continue the aims of this project by researching, creating, and distributing physical and digital education materials throughout the state. A social media campaign will be created that will allow organizations to promote coordinated messaging about MPAs. CMSF will also develop an evaluation method to understand how successful these efforts are in increasing compliance and stewardship of the MPA network. The second project will grant $2.5 million to the Resources Legacy Fund to improve compliance of MPA regulations statewide through community-based efforts. RLF will support the MPA Collaborative Network as a subgrantee to develop a statewide MPA curriculum and trainings for allied agencies, such as the City of San Diego Lifeguards. Working closely with the Department of Fish and Wildlife's Law Enforcement Division, this project will train allied agencies to connect with the public to improve compliance as their authority allows. RLF will also support MPA Watch as a subgrantee. MPA Watch is a citizen science program statewide that trains volunteers to collect human use data in and around MPAs. Funds will go towards supporting shore and boat-based MPA Watch programs. And this grant will also fund a postdoctoral fellow with the UC Davis Center for Community and Citizen Science to analyze 10 years of existing MPA Watch data to better inform MPA management. And lastly, the third project will grant $1 million to Coastal Quest to administer a competitive small grants program to increase MPA outreach and education products statewide. Last year, we partnered with Coastal Quest to administer a pilot small grants program that funded various outreach projects for the 14 MPA collaboratives that you could see in the corner right here in our MPA fair. The collaboratives produced these excellent outreach materials, such as the brochures and coloring books and children's activities guides that are displayed there on the screen, and many, many more. This grant will fund a new round of small grants program, which aims to release a competitive solicitation this fall, administered by Coastal Quest. And funded projects will focus on increasing public understanding of MPA regulations, reducing illegal take of marine life in MPAs, and engaging diverse stakeholders. That's it for those two items from the Once Through Cooling program. Would you like to do questions now?
Please.
Okay.
Any questions? Question around Once Through Cooling, and I should know this and maybe turn to my colleague, Bill Craven, but as I understand it, Once Through Cooling plants are being phased out. So presumably this funding source also phases out over time?
Yes, that's exactly correct. So right now we're receiving $5.4 million annually. As more and more Once Through Cooling facilities come into compliance, that number will decrease, and the program is expected to sunset in 2029.
Got it. Thanks. Jared.
Thank you for the presentation. I had a few questions. The first related to the Wild Coast project in San Diego, the wetlands habitat restoration project.
Yes.
Do we have good data on the relationship between wetlands restoration and the benefits to the marine protected area programs? And maybe you could briefly touch on that. Then I had another question.
Yeah, absolutely. So we don't have, published data per se about the connection between wetland restoration and MPAs. However, we do have estuarine MPAs, as mentioned, and the restoration that will be taking place outside of those MPAs. To be clear, none of the restoration is happening inside the MPA. It's happening in the surrounding area. We believe that the benefits brought to that area will be felt in the MPA itself as well. The MPA has the ability to protect the ecological resources there, and the restoration that happens around it will further bolster its ability to do so.
Okay, it'd be great to build into Mike's presentation kind of before as we think about what's useful policy interventions and how we think about the role of wetlands to kind of understand not only doing the cleanup, but the efficacy of how that promotes the health of marine protected areas.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the RLF one, when we're looking at kind of land-based compliance issues and MPA watch, like what what are the suite of things that we are looking to promote? And I'm not familiar with MPA Watch, but kind of what are the metrics that they're looking at promoting, and how are we thinking about compliance if we're funding the San Diego Fire Department? What are they doing?
Yeah, so I'll start with MPA Watch. The volunteers that go out and collect data on human use, they're collecting it both inside and outside of MPAs to see what kind of different uses are happening, if there's a difference between the two. And they're also looking at both consumptive uses, so that's fishing, collecting, tide pooling, you know, collecting from tide pools, things of that nature, spear fishing, and also non-consumptive use, which is recreational, surfing, scuba diving, etc. So they're looking at all kinds of, the way that people use both inside MPAs and outside of MPAs, because of course the MPAs are meant to be enjoyed recreationally, and some MPAs do allow certain types of take, as we mentioned in the beginning, within the conservation areas. So that's what MPA Watch mostly does. The connection with the San Diego lifeguards is a separate part. MPA Watch isn't connected with that project particularly. The San Diego lifeguards are, that will be a pilot project that we hope to expand to other city lifeguards and other enforcement authorities throughout the state, but we're starting with the San Diego lifeguards. They're very willing and eager about this, and that is because they're out on the water, they're out on the beach, they have certain authorities to be able to approach people who may be violating or may not be realizing that they're violating the MPA regulations, and they have the ability to educate the people there in addition to the law enforcement division for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, who of course also have the authority to do that and make citations.
Okay, maybe we can spend more time at a different point on that. In terms of the final question on outreach, the Coastal Quest grant, these are great, these images behind us. How do we measure their efficacy and their direct correlation to benefiting marine protected areas? Like, it's great that people are more aware, but like, how are you thinking about measuring efficacy?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that we've been thinking about, and that actually ties in directly with the grant to the California Marine Sanctuaries Foundation. They will be starting this formal data collection process on exactly how that is done, so exactly how the efficacy is turning out to be.
So that'll be a component of their program.
Yeah, exactly. That's a component of the grant.
At some point, I guess when I think about once through cooling, and I was pretty involved on working on those rules, when you think about kind of this money, the first thing that comes to my mind is wastewater discharges as being another source of huge volumes of water that's going in at a different temperature and different constituent base than the ocean. So I was anticipating maybe something more around that. So just thinking about in the future, kind of the things that are to me directly in the zone of kind of land-based sources of marine pollution that are end of pipe. Be interesting to think about what role that plays.
Really good point. Mike.
Following on the secretary again, not only the question of how to measure the impact of these outreach and education efforts, but more of a comment, you don't have necessarily a response, that some way of using whatever social science research is available to pick strategies for outreach and education and that have a higher likelihood of success. And at the same time, I'm hoping there'll be some efforts to think of new things, but we're spending a lot of money on it, and better to choose things that we hope have some evidence for being effective before you even do them, and then measuring whether that's actually the case.
Absolutely. If I can just reply to that, all of the efforts that have been undertaken thus far, and certainly what has come out of this pilot program from the small grants program, has been based off of years of experience, local experience of what has been working locally. We don't have the hard data to draw that connection between efficacy, but we certainly have anecdotal data about how, you know, people didn't know about it before, now they do, their kids are getting involved. So it has shown to be very effective thus far. And another thing about the small grants program specifically is that it is also expanding the amount of information in several different languages that was not available before. So that will certainly be a component of the efficacy study of how, what types of people are we reaching and how effective is it in different communities.
Helpful. Bill.
Quick question on the Rockweed proposal.
Yes.
So restoration from Big Sur to San Diego is a kind of a big deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any possibility that in addition to the habitat values, has anybody looked at carbon sequestration potential of rockweed, or is that a silly question?
I don't think that's a silly question. I think that that is something that I'm sure somebody is looking into. I am not certain if that's something that will go into this particular project or not.
Well, the only reason I ask is because that could open up additional funding options other than OPC funds.
Mm. A great point.
Well put.
Yeah, and I think that there's probably interest among council members in understanding where the Venn diagram overlaps in terms of investments in MPA and our work on climate and adapting the ocean to climate. Lieutenant Governor.
Well, you just caught my interest with that. And if there is additional information that you can share as part of these projects of what where the potential may be for carbon capture, that would be something I would love to hear back on at any point.
Absolutely. I will definitely speak with the PIs.
Yeah, and just to even underscore that point more, I think a lot of us, probably most of us, are really interested in understanding how the natural lands can actually be carbon sinks, but we need to think about how the ocean, obviously it already is a carbon sink, but how restoration in the ocean can remove carbon from the ocean, given ocean acidification.
Certainly. Thank you for that point.
The only other additional thing to look at in terms of the Venn diagram would be plastics in the ocean and litter prevention and all those other issues of land-based sources of marine pollution. So carbon's obviously an important one, but to the extent that we understand how this is reducing those inshore inputs. And recently, yesterday, actually, I met with some folks who are doing work on the Pacific Gyre, and they're looking at the discrepancy between what's in the gyre and what's coming from land-based sources, and their conclusion is that it's all in the inshore, and that all that is just getting cycled into, basically the three-mile zone that California controls. So it's kind of a disheartening observation, but I just want to make sure that we're tracking that.
Really good point. Let's move on to Adrian's presentation.
Hello, my name is Adrian Dayhood. I am the new senior environmental scientist in OPC's MPA program. And I almost feel like I should start this presentation with, and now for something completely different. Because unlike Mike and Tova, I will be asking you to consider funding for some scientific advisory groups to help us better structure the 2022 management review that Deborah and Mike have brought up, and to also help us structure somewhat of a novel review of the MPA network to understand what benefits it may provide as California deals with climate change. California's MPA network was established to meet specific ecological and social ecological benefits that were recognized in the Marine Life Protection Act, or MLPA, and these were listed specifically as goals. And these goals include things like protecting biodiversity, contributing to population viability, allowing for recreational opportunity. In 2016, the master plan for MPA set a specific requirement of conducting these decadal management reviews specifically to assess how well the network was accomplishing meeting the specific goals in the MLPA. Since the MLPA came into force, though, there's been increased interest in understanding what role the MPA network may play in providing resilience in the face of climate change. So while this climate change nexus is not a mandated part of the 2022 review, such a review could be complementary to our decadal management reviews. It may help provide some additional context. As Mike mentioned, we have a guiding document, the Marine Protected Areas Action Plan, which lays a high-level framework for how we could translate the goals of the MLPA into questions we could use to evaluate in a review. And it does things, as Mike mentioned, like identify species that are important to track, identify habitats that are important to monitor. But what it doesn't do is provide specific guidance on how to integrate disparate data sets or how we come up with a synthetic answer for how well is the MPA performing. We have all these species, we can see how they're doing inside and outside each MPA, but how do we synthesize that information in a meaningful way to understand how the network is performing? Further, this document really doesn't address how we could evaluate the MPA network through the lens of climate change. OPC believes that it would be helpful to have an expert-informed approach to translate the goals of the MLPA into a list of specific, quantifiable, measurable, and answerable questions for the 2022 Decadal Management Review and subsequent management reviews. We think it would also be helpful to get similar advice to develop a climate change-focused review of the MPA network. And I totally forgot. There's a picture of a scientist monitoring. And now here's a picture of scientists in their natural habitat. OPC's science advisory team, shown here, has an existing working procedure that allows the OPC, the Ocean Science Trust, and the science advisory team to leverage extensive scientific expertise to convene working groups and address specific policy needs for ocean policy. We seek to convene two such working groups. Both would be administered by the Ocean Science Trust. We're asking for $250,000 for each group. And instead of showing you more pictures of scientists and their natural habitat, I'm going to show you some photos of happy animals in the La Jolla Marine Reserve. So our first science advisory group that we'd like to convene would be focused on facilitating the 2022 MPA management review. This group will work closely with our MPA partners, including California Fish and Wildlife and the Fish and Game Commission, and we'd work to develop a detailed, scientifically grounded plan to effectively assess the MPA for the MPA network for the 2022 management review. The second working group would similarly work to develop a detailed plan on how we could assess the performance of the MPA network through the lens of climate change. This group would seek first to synthesize the existing state of knowledge regarding how the MPA network could provide benefits to climate change, and then would come up with an evaluation procedure. For both groups, we specifically want the working groups to develop specific scientific questions that could be reasonably and meaningfully assessed during the course of the review. We want advice on methods for integrating disparate existing data sources and integrating the new data sources that we're seeking to fund here today. And we want approaches for conducting this synthetic network-wide evaluation. Another key part somewhat addresses the question that Councilmember Diamond raised earlier, is that we would like the groups to conduct a gap analysis. What other projects do we need? What else should we prioritize for funding so that we can have the most complete review in 2022? Collectively, funding these two working groups would improve the quality of the 2022 management review and could help us bring light on novel benefits that the MPA network may provide in light of climate change. And as I'm the last one in Team MPA to present, I will just remind you briefly that we are asking you today to fund 7 long-term monitoring projects totaling about $9.5 million, 2 restoration projects totaling just under $3 million, 3 outreach and compliance projects, and 2 science advisory team working groups.
Collectively, we believe that this $16.8 million investment in these projects would contribute significantly to the continued success of California's MPA network. And I'll just end with that, and thank you for your time, attention, and consideration for these projects. And if you have questions, I'm happy to take them.
Thanks so much, Adrian. I'll just observe that the two proposed grants for scientific expertise really addressed some questions that got raised by council members around really how do we utilize the monitoring and the impacts to inform policy in the decadal review. So I think it seems like money well spent from my point of view. Jared.
Thank you, Adrian. So completely concur with what Secretary Crowfoot said. I almost wish like we had the two science projects done so that we could evaluate everything else. But I guess my perspective going forward, as we think about, so we've got this year, which is in front of us, 2019, and then we have 2020 and 2021 as grant years before 2022. And some of these science projects take a while to reach conclusion. So, of the projects, the $16.3 or $16.8 million that we have, I would want to see, this is my own personal bias, based on what the director said is our unique role, like what can local governments do in terms of public policy? So if we're really driving public policy and most of California lives on the coast, we've got a lot of science here. We've got a lot of evaluation, got a lot of understanding, but not a lot of policy levers. I didn't feel like this gives us a lot of opportunity to really understand what is it that we can do to change behavior as opposed to kind of how we monitor the health of the MPA system. So I'd be really interested in understanding everything from litter reduction. I mentioned wastewater treatment outflows, but obviously within the context that I work in, the Clean Water Act, for instance, understanding the loading and the permitting process of pollutants that are going through streams into the ocean, all the way through policy issues that when I go out, I hear a lot about, for instance, in the Tijuana River Estuary Delta issues of the pollution coming from Mexico that are obviously affecting San Diego significantly. So it'd be really helpful for me as a new member to understand, like, yes, it's incredibly important to know what we're trying to affect and what has been the result to date of action. But as a policy making body, it'd be very helpful for me, as we did with Once Through Cooling that led to the funding that we're talking about today. What are those big policy levels that we should be considering as it relates to MPAs in the future so that we're not surprising anyone in 2022 when we get this information back that climate change is having an impact? That runoff from cities is having an impact, like baking in some of those questions into next year's funding so that we have a better sense of the answers would be helpful.
Lieutenant Governor.
So thank you so much for this presentation, and it's really just so exciting to hear about all the opportunities for things that we can do in these areas, from restoration to public awareness. I'd just like to follow up on the comments of Jared's comments, because I've been spending quite a bit of time lately looking at the 2045 goals for California for combating climate change and addressing climate change. And California is the undisputed leader in the United States on this issue right now. And the commitment is clearly there. The pathway to 2030, I think, is there. But when we really start looking at how we're going to get to 2045, dealing with carbon already in the atmosphere is a very, very big part of what we're going to have to accomplish. And my understanding, I'm not a scientist, but my understanding is that the ocean itself is going has the potential of playing a role in this. And so since you have all the scientists and you're doing this work, I really encourage you to be thinking about the 2045 goals and what you can help to do using your expertise to inform back for how the work that you do could help support achieving those goals.
Thanks so much. And I think the point you're hearing is really on, you know, us really wanting to emphasize the linkage between the MPA investments with our broader goals on the OPC. I want to shift, we want to shift now to public comment. And as you know, attendees who have given public comment before, we ask you to limit your public comment to 3 minutes so we can work through our agenda here today. Please do fill out a speaker card if you would like to speak. And I encourage you, if you have any reactions or thoughts to add to the comments you've heard from council members, please share that in your public comment. We'll start with Craig Schumann, followed by Caitlin Gaffney and Calla Allison and Nicole Palma.
Good afternoon, Secretary Crowfoot, members of the council. I'm Dr. Craig Schumann, the Marine Region Manager with California Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm here to reaffirm the department's commitment to adaptively managing our statewide network of marine protected areas through a partnership-based approach that utilizes best available scientific information. The department supports the suite of projects before you today, and we wish to thank the council, your staff, and our really amazing universal partners that have gotten us to where we are today. We look forward to continuing to work closely with you all leading up to the 10-year review in 2020 and to continue to explore how we can leverage our MPAs to build resilience to climate change and to further inform and support sustainable fisheries management. Thank you.
Thanks so much, and thanks to your team. Your MPAs would not succeed without the work of you and your team, so thank you.
Thank you.
Caitlin.
Thank you and good afternoon. Caitlin Gaffney with Resources Legacy Fund. I want to start by just thanking the council and really thanking all of our partners at the state of California. It's been 15 years of this public-private partnership. It's back in 2004 that the Marine Life Protection Act initiative was launched and really set us on this path, which I think has been really extraordinary. It came up this morning that what California has accomplished is really a sort of a beacon and a template for others to look at, not only in terms of being really an ecological accomplishment, the statewide network of marine protected areas, the what that's been accomplished, but also really the how, that this has been an extraordinarily participatory and science-based effort really from the start. So 15 years of that, and I think the evidence of those partnerships is, you know, behind me here. It's great to see some old friends, Art Seavey. We worked on the Central Coast MPAs together literally 15 years ago. And, you know, here we are 15 years later with a room full of people, a state, really, a coastline full of people and organizations who are pulling together. Extraordinary example of interagency coordination with the statewide leadership team that I really think is a model for us to look towards for complicated problems throughout state government, but also the partnership, of course, between the public and the private sectors, all of the community organizations, tribal nations, and others who are such a critical part of this. So just really want to thank you, thank the staff, and everyone here, because this really has been an incredible partnership and a joint effort. The state commitment today, amazing, but of course only the beginning. It's taken us a long time to get where we're at, and it's going to take a long time to sort of set us back on track towards a path towards abundance and restoration, but I think we're on that track. Happy to answer any questions if you have them about the specifics of the RLF proposal. I think you'll also be hearing from the head of the MPA Watch program and from Cal Allison with the MPA Collaborative Network. Our role is to pass those funds through to others doing the good work. But happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thanks so much, Caitlin. I think I can speak for everyone when I say the appreciation is mutual. It's gratifying to sit up here and consider giving these funds away for good uses. But, you know, the progress we've made in the last 15 years is really thanks to the groups represented here today and across California. So thank you. Let's move on to Calla and Nicole, followed by Shauna O and Emily Parker.
Good afternoon. My name is Calla Allison. I'm the director of the MPA Collab Network, and I did want to answer some of the questions you had about the MPA compliance initiative. So just to give you some background, we did a round of enforcement trainings in 2015, 2016, and we brought together all the allied agency officers and trained them. So we're talking about Harbor Patrol, State Parks, Rangers, and lifeguards. Let's see, we had Beach Patrol, CHP, BLM, Rangers, basically anybody that had any type of enforcement authority and had jurisdiction that overlapped with Fish and Wildlife, and trained them in doing MPA enforcement, and also as a part of that, tracking their contacts that they're making in the field. So really seeing what impact we had to assist Fish and Wildlife officers and making sure that MPAs were being complied with those regulations. Part of that too is reaching out to district attorney's offices and making sure that when violations actually were cited, that they were being prosecuted. That's a big part of it. And also we hope to have compliance workshops where we reach out to the community and get their input on what the compliance issues are in their local areas. So that's a part of what we're hoping to do and continue with this next round of funding. Really appreciate all the support from you guys. Really empowering the local communities to take on this effort, and we're excited to move forward.
Thanks so much. Jared may have a question.
Thank you for that really helpful explanation. It'd be great maybe working with staff to understand what the enforcement baseline is, the number of inspections, the penalties levied, the criminal actions taken, so that we can understand how these tools shape and inform that policy, and kind of the total number of compliance actions taken, how many were associated with a fine versus compliance assurance, just so, you know, including kind of injunctive relief, so that we can get a sense of we intervened and this is really the landscape that has changed as a result.
Absolutely. And we also want to make sure we're not just, like you were saying, not just tracking violations and tickets written, but the contacts made. You know, how many warnings were given, and then those people actually complied with regulations because they were contacted. So that's something we'll be working with staff to make sure we track and report back to you.
Thanks, Jared. And I note that staff was taking notes on that in terms of tracking enforcement. Spoken like an experienced regulator. Nicole, did you have anything to add?
Hello, my name is Nicole Palma. I am the new program manager with the Collaborative Network. So I just wanted to introduce myself and say that seeing how California works with its network of MPAs is really inspiring for me. I'm not from the area, so it's really interesting to see how the public-private partnership works in coordination with everyone who's here today, and that I'm really excited to hopefully work on this next round of small grant projects. Hopefully you guys got to see some of the awesome projects that were created in the first round. So thank you.
Thanks so much. Next up, Shauna Oh.
Good afternoon, Secretary Crowfoot and members of the council. I'm Shauna Oh, I'm the director of California Sea Grant. I wanted to take this opportunity to introduce you to our program. And it's a funder. We're a funder with a partnership between NOAA, State of California, and universities throughout the state. Some of you, I think, know us through the Sea Grant Fellows, specifically the California Sea Grant Fellowship program that places very talented young scientists in agencies in the state, as well as the Canals Fellows. I just want to take a quick second to have the current fellows and former fellows in the room raise their hand.
Wow. Okay. It's a serious farm system.
Okay. So, but in addition to the fellowship program, our program also funds research throughout the state on coastal and marine topics with application to society, economy, and the environment. Each year we fund through NOAA grants about $1 million to $2 million of research projects. And we also have 9 extension specialists who conduct research and outreach in coastal communities up and down the coast, starting from Humboldt County all the way down to San Diego. So as was highlighted in the workshop early this morning, as well as many speakers before me, including the OPC staff, California's current system of MPAs is a result of a long process that connected science, stakeholders, and communities. And it's one example of our program, or Sea Grant specifically, works between science, stakeholders, and the public to help inform policy. So our extension team, in particular our former extension director, Rick Starr, who is now retired from the program, played a key role in the science behind California's MPA design. In fact, a proposal by Rick Starr became the foundation of the Marine Life Protection Act. And he and other researchers actually here in this room were very much involved in the implementation of the MPA network. So, and one more thing, he actually was the creator, or he started the California Collaborative Fishery Research Program that you saw the slides of with happy anglers and large lingcod and vermilion rockfish. In the past 15 years, Sea Grant has also funded more than $2 million of research projects related directly to MPAs through our federal funding opportunities. And the program has partnered with the state to administer the baseline monitoring program that you heard about from 2007 to 2018. We're excited again to partner with OPC and the Department of Fish and Wildlife to manage the MPA monitoring projects that will run from the next 2 to 3 years. And the 7 projects, as again highlighted by Mike, was selected by a panel of experts based on the statewide monitoring action plan. The plan actually is the game plan for long-term monitoring program in California. So the awards are very large, as you saw, and they're collaborative. So including researchers at 24 universities, agencies, and institutions in the state. So I just wanted to thank you again for the support to facilitate long-term monitoring in the state.
Thanks so much, Shauna. Emily Parker, and then followed by Art Seavey and Amy Wolfram.
Good afternoon, Secretary Crowfoot and council members. My name is Emily Parker, and I'm the coastal and marine scientist at Heal the Bay. We're based in Santa Monica down in Los Angeles. On behalf of our team and our 15,000 members, I'd like to take a moment to thank the council for continuing to support the efforts of our organization and others to protect our marine resources. I'd like to express strong support of OPC funding long-term MPA monitoring projects, as this research is essential in informing how our network of MPAs are functioning as we approach the 2022 decadal review. I'd also like to express strong support for the OPC funding of MPA outreach, education, and compliance projects. Over the last year, Heal the Bay has co-led the Los Angeles Marine Protected Area Collaborative, which is a member of the statewide collaborative network. And as part of that collaborative, we, with a grant from Coastal Quest and from OPC during the Phase 1 Small Grants Program, we helped to update a fishing guide, which you may have seen this morning at the collaborative booth in the back. And this is to help increase understanding of our local MPAs, ensure regulation compliance, and enhance fishing opportunities in Los Angeles. In October 2018, the collaborative also hosted the second Honor the Ocean celebration, which was a cultural event where we came together with environmental organizations, tribal communities, and students on the coast to celebrate the importance of marine protected areas. Apart from the collaborative, Heal the Bay has also ramped up our shore-based MPA Watch community science program, where we're training dozens of new volunteers in Point Dume and in Palos Verdes to contribute to long-term monitoring of human uses in our state's MPAs. These two programs would not be possible without the continued support of the council. So we strongly support the council's actions to continue funding long-term monitoring projects and the outreach, education, and compliance MPA projects as well. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Emily. Let's move to Art Seavey. Apparently, you've been around since the beginning. And then Amy and Angela Kemsley next.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Yes, I was a regional stakeholder in the MLPA process for the North Central Coast and worked with Caitlin and other people in this room to help design this North Central network of MPAs. And I certainly support the continued research and long-term monitoring. I'm really here to bring one issue forward, possibly, which has to do with the explosion of purple urchins along the coast and the resultant urchin barrens that have been created. I'm a partner in Monterey Abalone Company, and that's why I was involved in the MPA, the MLPA, because I was a regional stakeholder. So I'm really reporting to you from Monterey about the urchin barrens that currently exist there, and I really see them as, in some sense, a challenge to the MLPA process, because the urchins eat all of the the macroalgae that grows and everything else on the rocks there, and they completely eliminate the possibility of the MLPAs, in my opinion, fulfilling their roles, as someone this morning put it, more and bigger fish, greater biodiversity, and the possibility of carbon sequestration. They can't do that if there isn't any macroalgae, any productive base in the environment. So I'm urging the council and people in this room to take this seriously and consider it as an issue, not only for research, but also for policy, because people need to understand how can restoration happen in an MPA. And there are a lot of questions about that, understandably. So thank you very much for your time.
Art, just in a few sentences, what would you prescribe to address the purple urchin crisis that's eating the kelp and all the other algae?
I would prescribe removal experiments to remove. I know that in Santa Monica Bay, and perhaps others could address this, there have been removal efforts that have been very successful when kelp has returned, and I would prescribe that remedy in this case.
Got it. Thanks so much. Amy Rolfram, followed by Angela Kemsley and Richard Sadowski.
Hello, also from Monterey. I'm Amy Wolfram. I'm Monterey Bay Aquarium's Ocean Conservation Policy Manager, and I'm here to speak to about two items on the agenda that I'm here in support of. The first is funding for the Central and Northern California Ocean Observing System hosted at our sister institution, the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. California's ocean and coast face a variety of environmental stresses and changes that vary considerably over time and space. This project will pull together ecological and oceanographic data at a variety of scales, helping us to understand the effectiveness at our MPAs at state, regional, and local levels. The second project that I'd like to speak in support of today are the two working groups for the Ocean Science Trust to administer through the OPC's science advisory team. The first work group will provide vital scientific guidance needed to inform the 2022 management review. The second will consider the capacity of MPA networks to provide resilience to climate change, both a very important consideration for the MPA management review, but also will help California to lead in developing innovative adaptation and resilience tools that can serve as an example for others to emulate. At a time when our ocean is facing unprecedented changes, innovative partnerships like this are critical. Thank you for your support of these two initiatives.
Thanks so much. Next up, Angela Kemsley from Wild Coast and MPA Watch.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Angela Kemsley. I am the Conservation Development Manager for Wild Coast, as well as the statewide MPA Watch Coordinator. So I'm here to speak to you today in favor of two of the projects that are before you, 3B2, which is Wild Coast Restoration Project for 42 acres of degraded wetland habitat in San Diego County, as well as RLS proposal for community science work, including MPA Watch. So first, the Wild Coast Project. Wild Coast is an international team that conserves coastal and marine ecosystems and wildlife. And Wild Coast work with partnerships facilitated through the MPA Collaborative is not only on the forefront of ecosystem and wildlife conservation, but also the field of blue carbon, which is carbon captured by the world's oceans and coastal ecosystems. The salt marshes and seagrass beds protected by California's MPAs are some of the most successful ecosystems on the planet at sequestering and storing atmospheric carbon. Wetland habitat restoration is therefore a natural climate solution that can help make California be more resilient and allow us to better adapt to and mitigate the impacts of climate change. Wild Coast has had success conserving mangrove forests in Mexico, the other blue carbon ecosystem, and we've just launched a restoration effort for 100 acres of mangroves in the San Ignacio Lagoon, which is the world's last undeveloped gray whale breeding ground, which are the same gray whales that we see in our MPAs all up and down the coast of California. Wild Coast would like to offer to facilitate an exchange exchange between OPC and your counterparts in Mexico that we're currently working with in an effort to increase climate resiliency binationally through both marine protected areas and blue carbon ecosystem conservation and restoration. Now, my other hat is the MPA Watch program coordinator. So you heard briefly about MPA Watch. So MPA Watch is a community science program that was started along the Central Coast in 2008 to answer the question, are MPAs working or are they just paper parks? We've since expanded statewide. We have surveys, we have sites in every coastal county in California, and we work through a network. So we have regional partners in every county, every coastal county throughout California, who train and manage and oversee volunteers in their own local areas. So we've trained over 2,000 volunteers. We have over 850 active volunteers right now, collecting human use data in and around 58 different marine protected areas in California. And we use the human use data on both consumptive and non-consumptive behavior to create a snapshot of what humans are doing in and around protected areas. So we collect data on potential poaching that we can give to enforcement officials to help inform decisions. We also...
Fun going. I didn't cut you off.
I'm like, oh, is my 3 minutes up? And we also use it to inform what people are doing, all the good stuff people are doing too. Where are the surfers? Where are the scuba divers? To direct outreach and education campaigns throughout the state. So thank you very much for your consideration of our projects, and we look forward to working with you.
Thank you. That's a tall order to cover the ground you did in 3 minutes. And Secretary Blumenfeld's too modest to say this, but he spent a lot of his time in a past life working to protect the whale habitat in San Ignacio Lagoon. That's a conversation for another time. There you go. Thank you. Richard Sadowski, followed by Raymond Hemstra and Ricky Erickson.
Richard Sadowski from Homefront, EJ, Morro Bay. I want to kind of follow up with what Mr. Or Secretary Blumenfeld was saying regarding the carbon sequestration and the importance of the runoff. From a little background, we in Morro Bay have a Morro Bay East Estuary State Marine Reserve, and currently the Coastal Commission staff is leading a project for a managed retreat, which is more like a managed leap, and putting a sewer plant right over the watershed, where watershed is right, would go right into the State Marine Reserve, and it would threaten the MPA. The project threatens the MPA, and it's a bigger public health and safety risk than what we have right now. When you take everything into account, the other thing that I would like to mention is the link between ocean acidification and air quality. There's a huge data gaps along the coast with regards to air quality. And I sat on the Morro Bay Planning Commission for, it turned out, but when I sat there, we were doing an update on the general plan and local coastal plan, and the air quality element is an option in a general plan. And I feel that along the coast, we need to get that data, and the air quality is usually based on population, which is a variable that is not accurate enough. And I feel that one of the things that we should be looking at is monitoring air quality in the state marine reserves, and in a place like as Eelgrass, and that might be a way to get some funding from like the Air Quality Board, and collaborating when once through cooling funding starts to wean away. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Richard. Raymond, followed by Dr. Erickson.
Good afternoon, council members. My name is Ray Heimstra. I'm the associate director at Orange County Coastkeeper, and I'm also the co-chair of our local MPA collaborative, the Orange County Marine Protected Area Council. I'm here to support the staff recommendation, but I wanted to speak on three particular projects that are, you know, we've really seen on in Orange County. So the first is the rockweed restoration. We think this is really important. We've had successful restorations of eelgrass and in Olympia oyster in the marine protected areas in Orange County. And this rockweed restoration will give us important information on how to add that habitat too. So we really wanna think that's a good idea. On the enforcement side of things, Orange County Marine Protected Area Council sponsored the first enforcement training in there. And we really saw the difference because there's a lot of rotation of enforcement staff. And sometimes this isn't a priority or they may not even know the rules. A perfect example is after one of our trainings, we found out that the local Harbor Patrol wasn't even aware of the Marine Protected Area there. Afterwards, they were. And we saw enforcement go up there in actual changes. On the MPA watch program, we're very active with that. And again, we've really seen results on that through the data that's collected there, that's used by the state and the local agencies. We've seen docent programs move docents around, new signs. We actually, two of our cities have marine enforcement officers. So where they're put and their hours and things are partially influenced by that. And then lastly, I just want to mention the small grants program. That was something that was very helpful. Last time we printed up over 5,000 of our brochures, and our tide pool brochure, and then also the marine protected area map. So, and we gave them all away. So, I mean, they're out there. So it's really making a difference. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Ray. Dr. Erickson, we just have a few more. So if you do want to speak but haven't filled a speaker card, please do so. And after Dr. Erickson, Alexis Jackson.
See if I can make this work. Good afternoon, Secretary Crowfoot and members and staff of the Ocean Protection Council. My name is Dr. Ricky Erickson. I am the director of the Marine Protected Areas Program for the California Marine Sanctuary Foundation. And we are a nonprofit organization who are dedicated to supporting California's extraordinary marine environment through resource protection, research, and community education and outreach. And I wanted to follow up on this morning's discussion, and it's sort of evolved into this afternoon's discussion as well, in terms of do we know whether the MPAs are working, and do we know whether our investments, both private and the state and federal agencies in marine protected area education and outreach, are actually working. And first, a little bit of anecdotal evidence that we have as part of our outreach, and we're going to be continuing that if we get funded by the council today, to continue to target strategic ocean users. These are consumptive users and whale watching boats, charter fleets, bait and tackle shop owners, harbor masters and marinas. We do a lot of on the water and waterfront education and outreach. And we've been doing this since the initiation of the 2007 Central Coast MPAs, where we started our work. And I can certainly say that attitudes have shifted and attitudes are positive and much more supportive. I used to sort of have to put on my armor before I went into, you know, on the waterfront and walking the docks and talking to the charter fleets. And that has definitely changed. A lot of the fleet has sort of evolved into whale watching and marine mammal watching and wildlife observing types of things with the changes that we've seen in the oceans. So there is anecdotal evidence to that extent that we've seen from, we work from Oregon to Mexico, and we've seen that. We've been out there in advance of the fishing season now. So there's some of that evidence, and also with, you know, we've heard many of the needs to look at metrics of success. And I encourage you all, Tova this morning talked about in her report the needs assessment. So the needs assessment actually surveyed hundreds of different users, all sorts of users across the state of California. And that needs assessment actually looked at and proposed recommendations. And those recommendations were, I think it was Jared who was asking about which proposals do we know actually make a difference. And that looks at kind of a cost benefit and effectiveness analysis of these recommendations. And then finally, I did want to say that as part of the proposal for the foundation, the needs assessment
we will actually be doing a measures of success evaluation. And there has been work where we've consulted with an expert in metrics of success, and they will be, academics will be involved in that moving forward. So we encourage your support for all of the proposals that have been brought forward today. And I think that a lot of what we're seeing in terms of this shifting in attitudes is a result of your long-term commitment to MPA. So thank you.
That's really helpful. Thank you. Alexis Jackson, and then Marla Jo Sadowski.
Good afternoon, Secretary Crowfoot and members of the council. My name is Alexis Jackson, and I'm representing the Nature Conservancy. TNC is strongly supportive of the California Ocean Science Trust, continuing in their role as science advisor to the Ocean Protection Council, including a secretariat to the OPC Scientific Advisory Team. OST has really played a key role in engaging and mobilizing members of the scientific community, citizens, NGOs, and other partners on behalf of OPC's most pressing issues. Addressing global challenges such as ocean acidification and sea level rise really require interdisciplinary science that leads towards innovative and effective and policy-based paths moving forward. And so the collaborative partnership that we see between OST, OPC, and the OPC SAT is really unique to California and serves as an effective model to other states and really other nations. So TNC looks forward to continuing to work with OPC and OST to support collaborative research and also to develop science-based solutions that promote long-term management and conservation of our state's resources, particularly under these continuing changing ocean conditions. So thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thanks so much, Alexis. I'll share your observation in terms of the collaboration between OST and OPC being unique and effective and a good model. Marla Jo, and then lastly, Ruthie Maloney.
Good afternoon, Marla Jo Sadowski. I'm from Homefront Environmental Justice, Morro Bay. And I would like to speak today from the perspective of public due process in this whole, it all has to do with MPAs. It has to do with everything, right? But I would like to address, like, Mr. Blumenfeld. I also, too, from the public side, was an ocean outfall group leader in the state. So I worked for 20 years on that, getting rid of those ones through cooling. So I was probably hammering at Dominic. I know I hammered at Dominic really hard, but he's my hero now. But anyway, in Morro Bay, we have an estuary, and we used to have one through cooling inside the estuary, so that's gone now. We also have a state marine reserve in our East Estuary Bay. The problem that I want to talk about today is that you can't do this without the public. So if any question you have about is public education going to help, yes, it will. How that happens, it takes a lot of different avenues to get that through. And right now, the regulatory agencies, the Water Board, the Central Coast Regional Water Board, and the Coastal Commission in the Central Coast aren't up to speed. They're just not up to speed with climate adaptation, climate mitigation. They don't get it. And I'm saying that the public, a person like myself that's been involved in these things for years, absolutely must have the right to speak to local government agencies in public meetings and exercise the opportunities and the rights that we have to do that. Right now, the California Coastal Commission has decided to take the public hearing rights for a wastewater treatment plant that's 1/2 mile from the estuary. They're taking away our public rights, our opportunities to speak. And the way we get the public to know what's going on is public debate. And all the uneasiness, the uncomfortableness, even going through the MPA process, it wasn't fun. And the speaker just said, you know, she had to kind of feel like she had to get armor on to go down to the docks. Well, I know what that feels like. And the place that the public can reach the most local people and get this discussion going is public due process, and I hope that you support that. Thank you.
Thanks so much. And we had an opportunity to visit before the meeting, and I want to make sure that you have access to have a conversation with the folks at the Coastal Commission making those decisions. So I'm going to give you my contact information. Lastly, Ruthie Maloney.
Ayakui. Naknow Ruthie Maloney. I am from the village of Turup and Wetchpoos on the Klamath River. So I am also the program manager for Eagle Eyes of Falls Klamath Cove. That's a human use survey up in Dale Nort County. Mm. So I've also participated in the teacher toolbox kit. So I'm here to speak on behalf of tribes throughout the state of California. I believe, you know, we have been here since time immemorial. We have a vested interest in coastal resources. Marine resources are a key component to our ceremonies that we conduct yearly. It begins just even with our seaweed as a way that we have to prepare ourselves for our ceremonies. So there's a month preparation that goes into preparation for a ceremony that will last 10 days. That starts, a key component is our seaweed. So that's why I feel it's very important that tribes be included in ocean planning, because we are going to be here and we have the vested interest. So again, we're looking at MPA Watch. We also participate within that to try to protect our cultural ancestral lands. We have, and it's not an MPA, what we're looking at False Klamath Rock is a rock. It's a special closure for the birds. But we are looking at the human uses around the special closure of False Klamath Rock. And so, but that is also a traditional area where the Talawa, Yurok, Karuk, and Hoopa, if they had areas, like John Corbett likes to say, it's the UN. It's where they used to come traditionally if they had any type of disputes or anything. They would come to this area, they would use a certain language, and then they would figure out and make, you know, figure out a way to get, you know, make peace or stuff. So I guess I just really would like to see the funding. We've been working with RLF and MPA Watch and the Sea Grant. We've gotten the small grant awards. But again, I do live in Northern California, which, you know, we traveled here to get here. But that's one of the things is, you know, Northern California is very unique. We do have to take a lot of costs into traveling, and it's spread out, you know, rural counties, and it's hard to get to. So we're looking at funding is very crucial to us. So I'm hoping that, you know, that the Ocean Protection Council, and thank you guys for your consideration of these next round of fundings, and I'm hoping that we can get even a higher amount for North Coast and for tribal participation within ocean planning. And I thank you so much for letting me make comment today.
Thank you for your leadership on this. And I think you may win the award for the longest distance traveled to this meeting from the Klamath. So thank you for that. With that, colleagues, public comment is concluded. And since we had an opportunity to ask questions, I might suggest we entertain a motion on these grants, but certainly want to provide opportunity for any comments or questions before we do that. Good. With that said, would somebody like to make a motion? Great.
I moved.
Great. And I'll just clarify, or not clarify, but just confirm that the motion is to adopt the proposed findings for all the projects as recommended by staff, approve the projects as described, and delegate to Director Deborah Halberstadt the authority to implement the council's approval.
So moved.
Great.
Apologies. I do have to note for the record, why I'm broadly supportive of these projects. I have been advised that I do need to abstain from voting on number 3C2.
Okay, so I might suggest that we modify the motion to approve every grant except 3C2.
So moved.
Okay, all in favor of approval of those grants?
Aye.
Aye.
Now, can we entertain a motion for approval of grant 3C2?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, with that.
With one abstention.
With one abstention, thank you. With those votes, those grants are provided, and we look forward to the good work and also look forward to staff folding in the comments made by council members here today. Karen.
One thing I just wanted to make sure is that in order to help give visibility to the Ocean Protection Council, that every grant include language that shows the funding. So if we're doing a poster, it has Ocean Protection Council. If we're doing a cleanup, it has Ocean Protection Council. But that's clearly specified in the terms of the grant. And then secondly, as we do the next round of funding, that you involve the council, because I want to make sure, to the point of the last speaker, that equity and geographic concerns are integrated into how we're making decisions, not at the end of the process. So that would be two things that would be helpful.
Thanks, that's really helpful. And on the second point, really just having a little bit more visibility on grant guidelines and ability to provide input. Obviously not possible given we just got here, but we look forward to that opportunity for the next round. So let's move on to items four. And I'll note items four and five, as well as two consent items, are those that we need our full quorum for. And I believe we'll have a quorum for just under an hour. So I want to make sure we get through these items in that time. Okay, and we have Paige presenting. Thanks. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I'm Paige Barabee, OPC's Fisheries Program Manager. Have some slides coming up here now. So this project in item four would provide up to $220,000 to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to develop the California Fisheries Portal, an advanced database-driven website, which would serve as a central repository and public interface for state-managed marine fisheries information. The initial development of the Fisheries Portal would include information on 38 state-managed species, which represent the majority of commercial landings as well as commercial and recreational participation in the state, and those species are listed in Exhibit A. This project builds off of two projects previously funded by the Council in January 2018. One of those projects funded in January 2018 supported collecting and synthesizing information on state-managed marine species that could inform California Department of Fish and Wildlife's development of enhanced status reports. And these enhanced status reports provide comprehensive and up-to-date information on species life history, fisheries characteristics, current management and monitoring efforts, and research needs in alignment with the Marine Life Management Act. The second project that was supported in January 2018 supported the scoping phase of the fisheries portal. And this included convening two focus group discussions, which informed the portal's design and development, and to better understand stakeholder needs for this tool. The second and final focus group discussion was held just earlier this month in May. And in between the first and second discussion, a prototype of the fisheries portal was created and by an external consultant who is funded by the Resources Legacy Fund. This prototype was informed by the summary feedback from the first focus group and was created to provide the group something to react to during the second meeting. Overall, we received very positive feedback from the focus group and that the prototype was on the right track and would be helpful across a range of stakeholder groups. The stakeholder groups that were included in the discussions were consumptive and non-consumptive dive community members, recreational and commercial fishermen, conservation organizations, academic scientists, and state agency and legislative staff. So the next slide is shows the prototype. So this is not exactly what the portal would look like, but is a helpful visual for what the focus groups discussed. And when fully developed, the portal would include information on individual state-managed species that could be sorted in a variety of ways. So these circles just indicate the various sort functions that were brainstormed and developed by the focus group, various categories by which the portal could be sorted in the various species. And when a user clicked on an individual species, such as barred sand bass here, the user would be taken to that species page, which would include information from the enhanced status reports, such as details on the barred sand bass fishery, including location, fishing effort, landings, and socioeconomic factors. The portal would be constructed to allow for inclusion of interactive data functions, such as mapping of catch and revenue over time, and the development phase of the portal would also include user testing with department staff and stakeholders. Overall, the California Fisheries Portal will promote transparency in fisheries management, improve the accessibility and standardization of species-specific information, focus academic research on areas of management relevance, and foster public engagement. Thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thanks so much. Just a quick question. Who do you envision? I mean, you mentioned the
type of stakeholders that were participated in the development and the focus groups. But what are a couple of few examples of where you think the portal will be sort of effective towards management of the fisheries?
I think there's a few examples that I can provide. I think one key area that everyone is excited about is to provide gaps or needs for academic research for academic institutions. So if there's undergraduate or graduate programs or projects, they could focus on certain priority species and help with a partnership-based approach to inform management of those species. I think a different example might be recreational and commercial fishing, just standardization of the information that's available for those state-managed species, and over time having, you know, closer to real-time information on catch and revenue available for those.
Thank you for that presentation. This seems like a really important, great project. Bless you. Why wouldn't it be funded directly and within the complete purview of what Department of Fish and Wildlife does day to day? I'm confused about why we're funding it as opposed to, seems great, seems completely what they would be doing day in, day out.
A great question, and I believe Dr. Craig Schumann is here and may be providing public comment, so I would invite him to offer any insights he has there. Within OPC's fisheries program, we work really closely with our state agency partners, so Fish and Wildlife and Fish and Game Commission, in addition to other stakeholders, and I think look for partnership-based approaches to fund priority projects that stakeholders have identified as important needs. And so this project I neglected to mention, but is part of implementing the Marine Life Management Act Master Plan in our draft strategic plan. That's a specific draft objective that we have and kind of builds on previous funding where we have worked directly with California Department of Fish and Wildlife. So I think in the fisheries program, you see that kind of close partnership there.
Helpful.
And I might ask Dr. Schumann to just to come up if you would. And just, so as Jared said, not, you know, clearly an important tool. Can you just talk about sort of why it's moving through OPC and also Prop 84?
Sure. So the, I think the short answer is this will help expedite the implementation. So as we've heard throughout much of the day today, there's been close to $40+ million invested in the Marine Protected Area Program, and we have not seen that kind of investment in fisheries management. So we are you know, doing the best we can with the resources we have, and to get something like this built in-house at the department, it would have to get in the queue with everything else. So with OPC's help, we're able to elevate the fisheries management projects, get a higher profile, move them higher in the queue, and get them implemented on a faster time frame.
Got it. I think Jared's about to recommend CalEPA funding for this item.
No, I was about to recommend that CalEPA get funded by all these programs, because like we got a great list too. What is your total fisheries management budget, just out of interest?
That's a good question. We are going through a service-based budgeting project right now, and hopefully at the end of that, we'll be able to give you a good answer. I'd have to go back and look at some previous numbers, but probably in, if we look at all staff and all in combined for commercial and recreational fisheries, probably about $7 million. It's about a third of our marine region budget's about $20 million a year, and we estimate about a third of it goes towards fisheries, but that does not include enforcement.
Cool. I mean, great project, don't get me wrong. Knowing what fish are and what their names are and what they look like just seems basic and important. Excellent. I have a request for through the chair to Deborah, which is at the beginning of the presentation, you gave us kind of analysis of breakdown of who does what, how. It would be great as we enter the next year to understand how our funding relates to our chunk and how our funding relates to helping others do their part. So, because it seems like a lot of what we're funding is outside the area of what we have authority for, but within the authority of important work that needs to be done in the other areas. And this would be one of those, and just understanding how we frame that out, I think is leading to my questions, and I don't want to create confusion or work right now, but just the analysis of these are the types of things that make sense for us to fund, and these are the things that we could do to help fund others who have a different mandate.
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to provide additional information and clarity on that. I will note in here the funding source for this project is Prop 84, which OPC received specifically to facilitate this type of work. I mean, it's the Prop 84 funding is pretty flexible, and it goes towards scientific data and towards assisting and convening state agencies and doing basically what OPC's mission is. And so this project furthers that on the sustainable fisheries side of our work.
Mike.
Can absolutely see the value of the portal, but its value only comes to fruition if the website and portal is maintained and continually updated. So what's the funding situation for that?
So the model that we use, and we've used it in the past now with OPC funds, and we've been successful, is that we hire external consultants to come in and do the programming, and we embed them in our data technology division to work with our staff in our programming languages. So they do the legwork, but then we maintain it over time. And so we're building that capacity to maintain it because we have that exact same concern.
I think that's an excellent point, though. And our request and expectation would be that it does get maintained and to remain a resource.
Most definitely.
Good. Jordan.
Well, as a fish nerd and data geek, I clearly love this project. But my question would be, you mentioned some of the interactive functions, would be actually about interoperability and how this is going to link with other databases and the information sets that we have, and especially in the strategic plan, the emphasis on kind of the open ocean data platform, et cetera. So just what is the thinking around that so that we don't have just another stranded data set?
The first focus group discussion kind of started at a high level, and it was like, what are all of the wish list items that stakeholders would like? And that's where a lot of the interactive kind of wish list things came up. So this project would build the website such that those could be added on in future phases, and without knowing all of the IT details, although I have spoken a lot with IT folks and learned a lot in talking about this project, but I think that the competitive solicitation or RFP would have requirements in there about aligning with state website requirements, and also in building out those or setting the groundwork for those interactive functions to connect with the, whether it's open data platform or any other thing that the state has. I know we have a license with Tableau, which is getting into really IT needs, but those would definitely be incorporated into the RFP.
And I'll just mention that we're really working to build an effort called the Open and Transparent Water Data Portal, which is implementation of Assembly Bill 1755. And that's going to have actually ecological data sets as well as just water. We've been thinking about that in the freshwater context, but obviously it's not binary, because a lot of the fish that are using our rivers are obviously using the ocean too. So it's a great point. The staff should just give more thought to how it integrates with that broader data effort. Good. So considering questions have been answered, can we entertain a motion to approve funding for item 4?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Great. So I think that's consensus decision. Let's move forward to item 5, which is consideration and possible adoption of Prop 68 grant guidelines.
Can everyone hear me all right? Great. Good afternoon. I'm Holly Weyer. I'm the Marine Pollution Program Manager at the Ocean Protection Council. I'm also the staff lead on the Prop 68 grant guidelines, which is why I'm here presenting them today. Before I jump into the guidelines, I'm going to provide a very brief overview of Prop 68. Then I'll go into what we're proposing to use our Prop 68 funds for, the contents of the guidelines, the process we went through to develop them, and our response to public comment. Prop 68 was passed by voters in June of 2018. For folks in the audience, you may have heard this referred to as the Parks Bond. The proposition overall authorized $4 billion in general obligation bonds for state and local parks, environmental protection, restoration projects, water infrastructure projects, and flood protection projects. The overall purpose of Prop 68 is to connect Californians with their parks and natural spaces. Prop 68 also includes a number of requirements to ensure that funds reach California's disadvantaged and severely disadvantaged communities. Deborah went over this briefly at the beginning of the meeting, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but Prop 68 funds will be used to support all of OPC's program priorities, which are broadly outlined in our guidelines in Section 1.4. We've in total been allocated just over $56 million from Prop 68, and $35 million of that is in Chapter 9 for marine wildlife and ecosystem conservation, and just over $21 million of that is for coastal climate adaptation. The proposed grant guidelines are going to cover projects funded both through Chapter 9 and through Chapter 10 funds. The types of projects we would fund to achieve our program priorities include scientific research and monitoring, including development of innovative tools or technology, restoration or other on-the-ground projects that would improve ecosystem health and water quality, planning and implementation projects that advance climate adaptation and resiliency, and projects that provide access to the coast through infrastructure, citizen science opportunities, and education. Oh, interesting. It did not look like that on my computer. So the grant guidelines really provide the overarching framework to guide our funding decisions. They establish the general process, procedures, and criteria that OPC will use to solicit applications, evaluate proposals, and award grants for Prop 68 funds. The grant guidelines also explain the project requirements and evaluation processes to potential applicants. Another way to think about the grant guidelines is that they include things we want to remain consistent regardless of what program the grant's being offered under at OPC. Future solicitations under Prop 68 will provide additional details for applicants, including things like the minimum and maximum funding amounts, specific priority areas or topics covered by the solicitation, and additional details on topics like technical assistance. Our public outreach process to develop these guidelines exceeded the requirements of Prop 68. I'm really sorry about the graphics. I don't know what's happening up there.
No worries. The words are still there. Those are the important parts.
So we released the draft guidelines for public comment on January 7th, and we began holding our stakeholder workshops on February 11th, and then we closed the public comment period on February 28th. We also sent out a letter to California tribes informing them that our draft guidelines were out for review, and we let them know about the workshops and the webinar and encouraged their participation. Our workshops had two identical sessions, one in the afternoon and one in the evening. This structure was intended to engage stakeholders who might be unable to attend a workshop during regular business hours. And in between the two sessions, OPC staff was available for office hours where stakeholders could discuss their comments or questions about the guidelines with us one-on-one. We also held a webinar during the public comment period to provide information to stakeholders who might not be able to make it to a workshop in person. So altogether, the workshops and the webinar reached 70 individuals. So we received 8 public comments representing 14 organizations. I'm not going to go over every public comment we received because we would be here for a very long time, but I wanted to highlight some of the comments we received and the changes that we made. We received a comment noting that our requirement that applicants have a history of success discourages inexperienced applicants in disadvantaged communities from applying. So we removed that requirement. And instead, what we were really trying to get at with our original language was that if someone had a bad track record of managing public funds, then we reserve the right to not offer a grant to them. So we put language closer to our intent in the final. We also received a comment that our approach to integrate community access funding into other projects would be less impactful than providing community access funds for standalone projects. This was probably the largest revision we made in the guidelines. So we revised the finals to provide community access funds for standalone projects. We intend to release solicitations specifically for community access projects, and community access projects have their own scoring criteria in the guidelines. Finally, we received a comment requesting that applicants justify how their projects serve disadvantaged or severely disadvantaged communities. We did have this in our draft guidelines, but in the final, we really emphasized it, and we de-emphasized the distance a project was from a community. Oh, yay. We've got one. All right, so if the guidelines are approved, OPC staff would plan to release solicitations for projects in June. And I realize this was a very short, very high level presentation, so I'm happy to take questions.
Thanks so much, Holly. Maybe I'd have one comment and a question. The challenges that we face regarding oceans are so broad. And so we see, at least in the initial draft of the strategic plan, a really broad agenda. And it seems appropriate in some levels because we have this diversity of challenges and opportunities. But then at the same time, in the back of my mind, I worry a little bit about, you know, are we going to be able to move the needle in any one area if, you know, we have this broad portfolio investment? So given that, would you say, how would you characterize sort of what we expect to focus these Prop 68 funds on, given the grant guidelines?
Deborah looks like she wants to take that. So one thing I would say is that with our Prop 84 funding winding down, Prop 68 provides ongoing resources to support projects that are similar to those funded by Prop 84, like the scientific research and restoration. And it also provides some new opportunities for us to fund things like community access, which we haven't had specific funds set aside to do in the past.
Yeah, thanks, Holly. I agree with those comments. And I would say, because we have a variety of funding streams available to us, and I walked quickly through that pie chart earlier this afternoon, we do have some Prop 1 funds that are able to be dispersed across all of the different program areas and that really target things like marine pollution and wastewater treatment and water quality, but also are supposed to have a link to things like sea level rise and how do we maximize the benefits that we're getting from the projects that we're funding. That's always in the back of our minds, is how do we fund as much as we can, get the biggest bang for our buck, and how do we leverage other funds? So, you know, how can we collaborate with different agencies who might have other funding sources that we can support or fund the beginning of, and they'll fund a different phase. So we work really closely with other agencies to ensure that we have as much capacity as possible. And then I would say that, you know, $56 million is not an insignificant sum, and we can do a lot of really, really important work with that money. And because it was divided up, we have the $35 million for marine ecosystems that really targets, again, the sustainable fisheries, the marine protected areas, the marine pollution type work. Then we have a separate set of funds that we can devote to climate. Of course, climate impact in those areas, and those impact climate. So we'll be able to kind of move between the two funding streams to develop a cohesive program.
Got it. That's very helpful. And I just think it's a question that I want to ask as we consider the strategic plan, is just that, you know, sort of that those relative investments and how broad can they be versus concentrated? Jared.
Just following up from what Wade said. So the first meeting that we had really focused on the strategic plan, and there was a lot of items that were considered in the strategic plan. And I think we wanted to narrow them down a little bit. So kind of advancing on what Wade said, the more that we know in the strategic plan what we want to do and how we want to implement it, the more the Prop 68 funds can go further. Because although $56 million is a lot, it's also not given the context of the challenge. So Maybe where are we on the strategic planning exercise? That would be helpful.
That's the next item on the agenda. But at the same time, I do want to just, because I know we're getting a little tight on time as far as maintaining a quorum, I do want to highlight that we're intending to host a summer workshop for the council with the staff to really walk through the strategic plan and talk about what the priorities are that we included in the draft, where you would like us to narrow and focus, what types of metrics you want us to be thinking about. We want to have a dialogue with you, so stay tuned for that.
Good. So we can talk a little bit more about the strategic plan in the next item. So we have the Prop 68 guidelines before us. Any final questions? Mike.
Holly, the ongoing issue of public access and just how much public access is consistent with ecosystem health for any particular geographic area. What's going to be in the guidelines that's going to give applicants some, I'll say, guidance as to how their efforts that would fit under this particular category will be evaluated? Because I was looking for something specific in the guidelines and I see generalities.
You're right. It is very broad right now. I think that's something that we would work towards in future solicitations. We do have some list of example public access and community access projects in the guidelines that will hopefully give applicants some ideas of what we're looking for. That being said, we want to leave some flexibility and room for creativity. Those examples weren't in the scoring criteria themselves because we didn't want to make it look like we want these four things and these are the only four things.
Just a follow-on. So not asking specifically about that aspect to it, but the aspect of consistency with long-term ecosystem health. I'll say in my neck of the woods in Santa Barbara County, there's a raging issue about public access to Hollister Ranch. One of the things that the ranch owners argue is if you allow public access, i.e. non-ranch owners, you're going to wreck the whole place. What I want to ask you to do is consider having some kind of guidelines about what tools, what metrics, what kind of analytical protocols should be used to proposers for grant funds, applicants for grant funds, should use to make this balance between public access and preserving ecosystem health. So
that's a great suggestion. Thank you.
Mike, thank you. I do want to note we have one requested public speaker, and she was very reasonable. And she said, no need to speak if you're trying to speed through the agenda. But we want to make sure that folks can provide public comment. So let me ask Anna Zivian from Ocean Conservancy to come up.
Good afternoon, and thanks, Secretary Crowfoot and council members. Really appreciate your approval of the previous action items as well. I was going to speak on item 4, but you approved it, and I'm happy about that. Just wanted to say we really appreciate the outreach and revision process, support the guidelines, including the focus on coastal access, especially for disadvantaged and underserved communities. And also appreciate the focus on addressing key ocean and coastal stressors and change. And I think Deborah's explanation of how to ensure impact was very useful, and the link to the strategic plan was as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
add a follow-up question. So just so that we're clear on this, so these grant guidelines, once approved, will then lead to a solicitation, you said, in June?
Yes. Okay. We are planning to do 4 calls for proposals over the next several months, and they would be soliciting projects that advance adaptation and resilience against sea level rise and ocean acidification. They'd address plastic pollution, and projects that increase scientific understanding and solutions to improve kelp forest resiliency. And finally, projects that would involve data gathering to inform marine renewable energy development.
So based on that, so these guidelines are within those categories, who would be able, what the conditions for application would be and how we'd rank them, but they're not, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, so these guidelines include, you know, what evaluation criteria those projects would be ranked against, overall things that we want all applicants to provide with their applications, but then we would be releasing individual solicitations on each of those 4 topics that provide a lot more detail on exactly what we want, what our priorities are, that sort of thing.
So your point is that the reason that they're so broad is to allow everything from plastic pollution to enforcement to exist within them.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes me happier. Thank you. Because if they're very broad, then when I thought we were soliciting under this rubric, but this is a meta frame.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I guess to the director's point, before we went out with those individual solicitations, I would want to make sure we as a group have coalesced around priorities. So while I'm happy to forward this, I wouldn't want us to develop the priorities under which we will go out with solicitations until we work out as a group, because otherwise we end up kind of where we were today with some great projects, but ones that may or may not align directly with the new direction.
Yeah, and when you consider the scale of funding for Prop 68, it's a significant amount of money, as you said. So we want to ensure that its spending does align with the updated strategic plan, is I think Jared's point.
I want to make sure I have clarification on this for going forward. So we received an allocation of $10 million under Chapter 9 and $10 million under Chapter 10 in the 2018-2019 fiscal year. We will receive another allocation, hopefully, in next year, for the following year. We don't have agendized adoption of the strategic plan imminently. So if we pause to wait until we've adopted the entire strategic plan, we will be quite late in funding these kinds of projects. So we can certainly pause and wait and, you know, speed up our work on the strategic plan. There are some types of issues that are a little bit more timely and a little bit more critical that I think would benefit from getting funding. And when we talk about plastic pollution, that one isn't, it's always timely. It's not on a rush scale the way something like kelp devastation might be. So going forward, we're just trying to think how we can move some of these priorities forward while ensuring that they match the council's priorities.
And can I ask what the schedule, so the next at the next regularly scheduled meeting, would we actually be reviewing proposed grants based on this?
No. So the process would be, let's assume hypothetically for the moment that you approved the draft guidelines, and in June we issued an RFP on plastic pollution, say microplastics, which is something that we've been mandated to do by the legislature, right? So we would issue an RFP, and we would convene an expert panel, and we would give the applicants time to submit their applications, and it would go through a review process by the expert panel, it would go through a review process by OPC staff, and then it would come to you. So it probably would be not until, you know, the winter meeting at the earliest.
Right. But your point is that if we're asking you to hold off on the solicitation until we complete the strategic plan later this year,
then that process doesn't begin until probably late fall or whenever we approve the strategic plan.
Yeah, so if you approve the strategic, let's assume you approve the strategic plan in November, and then we issue the RFPs, we wouldn't be funding anything under Prop 68 until 2020.
Yeah. I mean, I think my own thought is, you know, the new administration, you know, takes office, you know, amidst sort of ongoing funding streams. And I think we're desirous of advancing a strategic plan that we can all be really excited about and really helping shape it and ultimately having that inform funding, which is a key resource that we, you know, will make change with. That being said, you know, Jared, I think what I'm realizing the reality is that some of these funding cycles are, we're just sort of getting them midstream. And while we may not be able to have, you know, this funding allocated this year really reflect the new priorities we would be able to do next year. Is that the?
Well, I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to be funding things that don't reflect the priorities of the council. So the four that Holly listed that we were anticipating potentially releasing in June were addressing plastics, kelp, ocean acidification and sea level rise, and what was the fourth one?
Offshore renewable energy.
So if there are any of those that you know you want to take off the table, that would be helpful to know immediately so that we can start reprioritizing not just grant allocation, but staff allocation. If there are ones that you think are, you know, you want us to move forward with, that would be helpful too, and we can back off. I mean, we're responsive to you, so.
I mean, I defer to the chair on this, but I think the complexity is not that there are a million amazing projects out there. Every single person sitting here probably has a project behind them that is worthy and could be very impactful. The question is, how do we coalesce around a few things that, one, relate to each other, and two, build into a narrative of what we can accomplish in a four-year term? So all those things sound great to me. And I don't think that's our question. It's not that we're objecting to any of them. We just want to understand how they relate to each other, how they leverage other resources. To the Lieutenant Governor's point, is there GGRF funding that could be brought in if we bring this project? If there's, so in this funding universe, to the extent where we're kind of like a foundation, like how we understand our strategic priorities has to be, I think, calculated in such a way that we're having the biggest impact, the most amount of leverage, the most amount of change. And so any one of these sound great. And the question is how kind of the sum total is more than the individual components.
I'd just like to reinforce those comments. I couldn't agree more. And I think that sometimes it's helpful to think about it in terms of what the public understands about what we're doing with all this money, right? Because you can have guidelines that lay out all of these very important things that we should be addressing. But at the end of the day, I think that people, taxpayers, want to know what is being accomplished with the funds. And at the State Department, we used to talk about the difference between output and outcomes. And thinking in terms of outcomes is really, really important, especially because, as Jared noted, in one context, it's a lot of money. But in another, with the challenges we have ahead of us, it's going to help us with part of these very important challenges. And so the prioritization process is really important. And if we think of it in terms of being answerable to the public and saying, look, these funds were allocated, this is what we did with it, and this is why that was a good thing to do.
That's really helpful. So can I just ask a question around the consequence of delaying the solicitations? We could, for example, approve the guidelines here today and simply request that the solicitations get delayed. Beyond just delaying essentially the money going out the door by several months, are there implications because of the allocation happening this year? Our lawyer shakes her head. You gotta turn your mic on.
So budgetarily speaking, no, because they're usually appropriated for two and you can encumber in three. So what that means in regular people talk is you have some time to spend the money.
So I would just ask for staff. I mean, I'll observe that open meeting laws are meant to make decisions in public, and we're definitely having that conversation in public. And so it's open meeting laws at work, but would ask Jen or Deborah for comments if we did, per the Lieutenant Governor and the Secretary, potentially consider delaying the solicitations to really conform with the new strategic plan, what that would mean.
I think
Before you answer, just it would be great to understand when is our next meeting and then when's the following meeting.
Right. So two responses. One is, I mentioned just moments ago that we'd like to host a workshop with the council on our strategic plan in the summer. So what we can do is host that workshop, delay solicitations until after that workshop has been completed, so we've had a chance to talk with you about those priorities. The next council meeting is scheduled for August, and then after that for November. So if we can fit the workshop in, you know, June, July timeframe, we have plenty of time to get those RFPs off the ground, and then still have the August, not have to wait until August to continue the discussion.
Yeah, the only nitpick I would observe is we would probably want to finalize a strategic plan just to ensure that, you know, we have a workshop, the public comments on that, we have a chance to reflect upon public comment, et cetera, and actually finalize the strategy.
So is your direction potentially to finalize this, do a workshop in June, finalize the strategic plan, and bring it to the council for adoption in August, and then release an RFP after that?
Yep. Jared says yes. I think I agree. but I also want to recognize that the strategic plan is really our roadmap for the next several years in the administration. So what I don't want to do is rush through a strategic plan just to get a, you know, one set of solicitations out the door. So my recommendation might be for us to approve these general guidelines and separately to request that staff hold off on the solicitations until the council agrees that it's timely and appropriate, which would be once we approve our strategic plan. And if, you know, we identify in the intervening weeks or months that creates a major problem, we can revisit this at our meeting in August. So I'd ask for a motion on these broad Prop 68 guidelines.
So moved.
Great. So the motion is to approve the guidelines. Jared seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So consensus decision there. Thank you. There's one more set of votes that we have to make, and it just refers to items we put on the consent calendar. So I just want to at least identify what those items are. The notion of being put on the consent calendar is that they are ministerial. But of course, we welcome any council comments on them. First is the consideration of authorization to disperse funds to the Ocean Science Trust for the purpose of ongoing support as OPC science advisor and the OPC science advisory team's secretariat. And that's ministerial, of course, because the Ocean Science Trust is an integral part of our work at the OPC. And then the second is the approval of new science advisory team members, which have been nominated by the director of the Ocean Science Trust. Any questions, points of clarification on the consent items? Do we have a motion to approve these consent items?
So moved.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, that's a consensus decision. Thanks so much. Let's move on then to the update on the strategic plan. Jen.
Good afternoon, Chair Crowfoot and members of the council. My name is Jen Eckerly, and I'm OPC's deputy director. And I was planning on providing a summary of our process to update the strategic plan, including how the new draft differs from the previous plan, our process to solicit input, and our plans on development of the plan and completion. But given all of the discussion here today, I'm not sure it's the best use of anyone's time to walk through all of the changes that we had proposed, and rather maybe just highlight our process to solicit input and our proposal for kind of next steps and discussion with this council. Does that sound good to everyone? Okay.
It does.
Okay, great. So So I guess I would just say that fundamentally, the priorities that we identified in the updated plan really don't shift that much from what we've been working on over the past 5 years. But I really appreciate the conversation that's been happening today around thinking through how we really leverage the work that we're doing, how we identify opportunities for those cross-cutting priorities, and thinking through making sure that we've got a really strong foundation to direct our strategic investments going forward. So as everyone in this room knows, the strength of this plan and the impact of our work over the next 5 years really relies on meaningful engagement with this council, with agency partners, with interested stakeholders, and the public. So to that end, we provided an advanced copy of the draft plan to the council, our science advisory team, staff from the Ocean Science Trust, And we also, a week later, released a public version of that plan for a 30-day public comment. During the public comment period, we had an in-person meeting with our science advisory team and Ocean Science Trust, and we had an in-depth discussion about the plan and received great feedback from those partners at that time. Through the formal public comment period, we received 18 letters from social equity and environmental nonprofits, scientists, representatives from both the plastics and the offshore wind industry, the Port of San Diego, the Coastal Commission, and members of the public. Overall, those comments were very positive, and they really praised OPC for our thorough and ambitious strategic plan. A list of the key themes of our comments are in the staff memo for this item. A few highlights that I'll provide now. We received comments to prioritize the actions and identify metrics of success, to strengthen the environmental justice related actions related to impacts from sea level rise, water quality, and oil platform decommissioning, to expand community resilience strategies to address the unique needs of ports, harbors, and working waterfronts, to increase focus on water quality impacts from wastewater treatment plants, septic systems, and pathogen pollution, to include seawater desalination as a priority issue, and to include seafood traceability, piloting of ropeless gear, and other fisheries bycatch risk reductions. So I don't need to say this out loud, but I will. Today is the initial step in really soliciting critical input and feedback from you on the priorities and actions in the draft plan. I think we received a lot of preliminary feedback already, but as Deborah mentioned, to facilitate a more substantial conversation, we'd like to host an informal workshop with you and with our staff, and which would also be open to the public. We welcome direction from you on whether that seems like the best mechanism to have that information exchange, or if there's a better way to get that from you. A quick note on metrics of success. We are thinking about ways to revise the objectives and the actions to be more metrics driven. We really would appreciate feedback from the council on the types of metrics you would like to see and how to best report out on our progress over the next 5 years as we implement this plan. And finally, additional feedback from you and our partners and the public will really inform revisions to the plan. We will release an updated version whenever we're ready to do so. We will allow for additional public comment and final consideration by this council at a future meeting. So I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your time.
I would just thank you and Deborah and other staff for your patience. As you know, we, as many of us as new members, really get our sea legs with the OPC. I think you all are doing your good work of trying to follow the schedule to update the strategic plan, but it's created an awkward timing because we want to make sure that we're really collectively able to shape the roadmap here for coming years. So thanks so much for your patience on that. I personally think a publicly accessible workshop this summer, where we're able to do a deep dive, will be really helpful. And I just asked my colleagues to come prepared to really think about that. Last I'll say, as I have the mic, I think you're hearing from us around the question around sort of prioritizing, and to what extent would it be appropriate to prioritize or to narrow our priorities, and what are the implications of that, both positive and potentially negative?
Yeah, I think we're really looking forward to having that conversation. When we drafted this strategic plan, we really tried to make it to be high level enough to allow flexibility for us to do our work over the next 5 years, but detailed enough so that the public and everyone else understands what exactly we're trying to do. And so we really look forward to having those conversations with you and the public in general to really think about how to best articulate that so we can be most effective.
So I think most of you know that the reason that I sit on this body is in my capacity as chair of the State Lands Commission. So it rotates, or actually swaps back and forth, between the lieutenant governor and the controller, Betty Yee. And the third member of our board is the director of finance from the governor's office. And the State Lands Commission has a staff about 150 employees. Legal authority over the essentially the land underneath the ocean up to 3 miles offshore. So I cannot stress how incredibly important it is to involve the State Lands Commission as part of this process, because if, as we go forward, the strategic plan isn't just consistent, but anticipates the areas where the work of ocean protections is going to dovetail with state lands. It's not just an opportunity to do some really good things. It also can avoid some challenges along the way. And let me just also say that, you know, the health of our oceans is so incredibly important to the public. There is so much consensus in our state around the protection of the California coastline. And in my 4.5 months now of chairing the State Lands Commission, I just am so impressed with the quality and the caliber of the leadership there, the understanding of the issues that our commission is regularly dealing with, permitting included. And so I know there's already a robust dialogue, but I would really ask that this be central in this process, is ensuring that the prioritization and the some of the key elements of this plan, that you work them through with state lands so that we're all on the same page and also really able to focus and shepherd our resources as we deal with some of these critical challenges, most especially the climate change. Thank you.
Excellent point.
Thank you. I'm very much looking forward to this process of developing a new strategic plan for the OPC. On the issue of a workshop, I hope we will schedule at least a full day. I just can't imagine doing this in a half-day session. So my preference, full day, maybe it requires even more. On the issue of metrics, this has been my pet issue for quite a while. A couple of comments to think for you to think about. I think we need at this workshop some sense of how the various priorities would be measured, and they could be measured quantitative, qualitatively. Some issues there may be cultural measurements. I think there's all kinds of ways of thinking about them. As a council member, and I think all of us would welcome your ideas on it, on various things. One of the other things I want to say about metrics is it's worthwhile not only to think about them among yourselves, but to reach out to various constituencies and stakeholders and ask them what they think might be a good way of both defining goals and how you would assess whether we are achieving those goals. particularly around environmental justice issues, tribal issues, the fishing community, et cetera, as input to how we should think about both the priorities, how we would craft them, and how we would judge whether or not we're meeting them. And I've always raised this issue in the context of one of the things I think we as a council need to do is regularly have a check-in on how we're doing in terms of achieving goals that are in the strategic plan. I don't think we've done a very good job on that. And the last thing I'll say, and I'm one of the people have to leave early, I apologize. Very early on in my, I'm in the fifth year, I think, of my tenure as a council member, I've asked for, is there a metric for measuring ocean health? No. We don't have one. At least California doesn't have one. There's a whole bunch of, not a whole bunch. There are efforts to establish a measure of ocean health. If what one of the main things we're about is ocean health, and we talk about it an awful lot, we as a council have no way to say, hey, are we getting better at assessing where we are in ocean health, just assessing where we are, number one. Number two is the health of the ocean improving? We can point to marine protected areas. We can point to lots of little things. But overall, are we doing our job, which I think is protecting ocean health and a bunch of other things, and I don't think we have the tools yet to say whether we're getting to where we want to be. So please consider, and I look forward to talking about them in the workshop.
I think that's really helpful feedback. I just want to take a note of time. We're going to hear from Jared. We also have three members of the public who traveled here to speak on this, and we have a couple more things we're hoping to do here in the next several minutes. So, Jared.
Given that, I'll be super quick. Just to build on the Lieutenant Governor's comments, the Coastal Commission, having someone from the Coastal Commission and the Coastal Conservancy there, I think would be really critical. I'd like to think of it like framing it even like an ocean, a state ocean summit, where we bring people together and kind of understand kind of what we did with the climate action team, like where are people, what are they focusing, what are their priorities, how do we align those better. And then to Mike's point, SMART, you know, specific, measurable, attainable, relevant and time-based goals so that we know exactly when it's going to be done, how it's going to be done, how it's going to be measured. And that brings me my last point, which is really, I think we should have a facilitator that is focused on strategic planning in such a way that we do end up with those attainable goals and someone who can drive us towards really prioritizing so that at the end of this workshop, we have something that we can then refine and bring for a vote. Thanks.
Just in case you didn't think that you would have an engaged, creative, and constructively challenging council, you do. So let's hear quickly from, but great comments, and I agree with all of them. Let's hear from members of the public, Alexis Jackson, Eileen Maher, and Megan Emity.
I promise to be brief in the interest of time. Just wanted to start off by applauding the OPC really for the visionary roadmap that they've outlined in their draft strategic plan that will allow California to move towards better conservation and sustainable use of its resources. In addition to supporting the priorities around protecting and restoring kelp forests, ensuring sustainable use of our fisheries resources, reducing fisheries-related plastics pollution, and doing a better job to manage our coastal habitats, we really wanted to highlight the importance of the climate change lens that's been added add to their strategic plan. We feel that a number of the components that are outlined create key enabling conditions that allow us to have climate-ready fisheries management, and that looks like advancing fisheries and climate science in California, ensuring that we have adaptable decision-making frameworks in place. And so we're very encouraged by the progress and direction that the work's going and look forward to seeing the final plan.
Thanks so much, Alexis. And I invite you and other thought leaders in the room as we move into that workshop or summit this summer. You know, think about the question of narrowing priorities and the trade-offs there, as well as metrics. I think your thoughts this summer on that, given the council's interest in discussing that, will be helpful. Eileen.
Afternoon. My name's Eileen Maher, and I'm the Director of Environmental Conservation for the Port of San Diego. So the port is in support of your strategic plan, and we like to thank you for acknowledging ports and harbors in that plan. It's very important to us. The port is an economic engine for San Diego region. We provide over 44,000 jobs along the waterfront, $9.4 billion economic development for the region and for all of San Diego County. We have numerous partnerships, including with the State Lands Commission. Very important working under them. We've had our successful partnerships have formed 1,400 acres of wetlands in South San Diego Bay, creating a refuge, restoring wetlands, all providing habitat for fisheries. San Diego Bay is a rather large nursery habitat for to help with the MPAs. We are also supporting blue economy and aquaculture businesses. In fact, you had mentioned earlier about how to eradicate red urchins. And we are actually looking at a business that has a plan to do that. So it should be interesting, the outcome of that, when we actually evaluate the business. So we also strongly support you include mitigation banking in your strategic plan, since it does help protect coastal resources, provides economic benefit, has carbon sequestration abilities. Again, we appreciate the fact that you included harbors and ports and look forward to future collaborations with Ocean Protection Council. Thank you.
Thanks so much for the port's engagement, and Megan Emity from the port as well.
Good afternoon, Council members. My name is Megan Emity, and I'm one of two California Sea Grant State Fellows working at the Port of San Diego. And I really appreciate the opportunity to offer comment on the strategic plan from the perspective of a state fellow. This is my first experience working at a public agency, and with that comes prioritizing the public interest. The Port of San Diego is entrusted with promoting and protecting the five public trust uses, which include navigation, commerce, fisheries, recreation, and environmental stewardship within its jurisdiction. Balancing these uses in a way that allows for economic growth while simultaneously protecting, conserving, and restoring San Diego Bay and the surrounding tidelands is a challenge, but one that I'm excited to be involved in. Prior to working at the port as a fellow, I was working at Wild Coast, and my background was in marine conservation. And I had only really considered the latter three public trust uses that I mentioned, fisheries, recreation, and environmental stewardship. Now, I better recognize the importance of both navigation and commerce. Working at the port, I quickly realized how important the maritime industry is to the region and the state's economy. For example, at the Port of San Diego, we have a working waterfront that supports commercial fishing industry, two marine terminals, a cruise ship terminal, and many shipyards. These are uses which promote trade, activate the tourism industry, and provide many jobs. These uses and their associated infrastructure are essential for the port to function effectively, and we need a suite of strategies that can address the protection of this water-dependent infrastructure as well. We are really grateful for the OPC's recognition that we may need to implement unique adaptation strategies, and we hope that considerations focused on coastal community resilience will be broadened to more widely incorporate the special needs of ports, harbors, and working waterfronts and their associated infrastructure for public trust uses. This is a message we conveyed in our public comment letter and one that I'm glad to have had the opportunity to share with you today. The port acknowledges and appreciates the consideration given to ports, harbors, and working waterfronts in the strategic plan, and we greatly appreciate the many future opportunities to collaborate with OPC. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much. And if the number of hands that raised their hands at their former Sea Grant fellows is any indication, you have a long career in collaboration with OPC. So as we get, come to nearing the conclusion of our meeting, I just wanted to point out that there is an opportunity for public comment on non-agenda items. So if you have any public comment that is burning to provide, please let us know and we can facilitate that. Liz and Gretchen have been very generous to cede their time so that we can end on time. But and that is, of course, an update from the science advisory team and, of course, the science advisor. But Liz, why don't we just, oh, we actually have some comment. So guess what? You will have a opportunity to cede your time. So we're obviously ready to, you know, to stay here, or at least we can, many of us can be here to ensure that all the public comment happens. Those who have to leave at 4, we understand that. But without further ado, then let's hear public comment from Jeff Schuster of Oceana, followed by Caleb Trotter. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you very much, Secretary Crowfoot, members of the council. My name is Jeff Schuster, representing Oceana. I got a whole page of stuff to say, but I'll try to be very quick. We wanted to, again, thank the legislature last year for allocating $7.5 million towards sea turtle and whale entanglements. Included in that, Senate Bill 1017 allocated $1 million towards drift gillnet transition plan. And Oceana is currently working very diligently to raise money for that. We have some materials we're using. If you guys know anybody who would love to put their name on something big like that, if we raise $1 million, then that initiates the transition program and helps make things right and gives opportunities for the fishermen off our coast to move toward cleaner gear types. We are concerned that in response, the federal government is making a dramatic push right now to bring in harmful pelagic longline fishing, which could really undermine the success that I think the solution of Senate Bill 1017 is. And so we're asking the state to take a stronger position in opposition to that, consistent with the state's opposition to other misguided federal efforts like to expand oil drilling off our coast. Lastly, just as a member of the Dungeness Crab Fishing Gear Working Group, we're very excited to hear that there is an investment plan in the works by the OPC staff to think about how to spend the remaining $5.3 million, both on working gear priorities, as well as also hearing from Ms. Eckerly that the ropeless fishing gear testing is part of the strategic plan, because we see that as a major way that California can have a big win and be a leader on that issue. Thank you so much, and I appreciate you providing the time.
Thanks, Jeff. And if you want to give the handouts to somebody on the staff, maybe they can just bring them up so we can take a look at them after the meeting. Caleb.
Good afternoon. Caleb Trotter, Pacific Legal Foundation, on the same topic as the gentleman from Oceana. Since we submitted our written comment letter this week, we did notice in the executive director's report that there is some added clarification for SB 1017's dispersal of funds from the council. So we appreciate that clarification. So I'll only add one brief thing, and that's to reiterate our request that as soon as the Fish and Wildlife Department does establish its fiscal agent, that without delay, the council go ahead and disperse those allocated funds. Pacific Legal Foundation represents a group of sword fishermen, and seeing those funds flowing is very important to their decision whether to commit to the voluntary permit transition program. So thank you.
Thank you, Caleb. Douglas Jung, followed by Marin Farnham.
Finishing off lunch. Well, thank you, Chairman and the Commission. My name is Douglas Jung, and although I'm a renewable energy engineer scientist, I'm here as a diver and fisherman. My father, a disabled, partially disabled World War II B-25 reconnaissance photographer, when he eventually recovered, became a fisherman. He was very passionate. We were poor, but we were happy, and the sea gave us so much. We just love the sea. And his boat capsized at Point Reyes, and 28 days later, he washed ashore, came ashore at right below Hearst Castle. But he he loved to see, I loved to see, our family, friends, and family members loved to see, and our friends. And there's millions of Californians who loved the cultural aspects of the sea. This is a cultural bonding to us. And this purple urchin devastation that's come upon us has absolutely wreaked havoc. I mean, we have never seen anything like that. I've been diving over 50 years, and diving overseas, I would come back and dive here. I just loved it so much here. But this devastation that's coming across is basically... is destroying biodiversity. 95% of all the abalone in Sonoma County are now dead. They've starved to death because these urchins have eaten everything. And we've been watching this for 5 years as we raised the red flag and said, we've got a problem here. They're this big. When they get this big, it's game over. We need to do something. Urgency, urgency, urgency. So, This is very devastating to the coastal community in particular, the tribal community and the fishing community, and it's going to get worse. It's not just the abalone that's affected, but everything. I fished for 10 days at Sea Ranch this past year, where I would normally catch 10 fish from shore every day, big fish. I mean, I've gotten some 30 pounds. Casting from shore, and you got 50-pound braid, and this thing just sizzles, right? And you cast up for 30 seconds, it sizzles. I caught one fish in 10 days, one fish. So it's not that everything is going to be affected right down the food chain, right down the food chain. So your seals, your sea lions, your seabirds, and when it comes further down south, hey, your sea otters are going to be affected. It's statewide, and it's coming slowly. It's worse where we are, but it's coming. We're begging the council. We're trying to make this awareness that that this fire, my home burned down in the Tubbs fire, along with my research laboratory office and 6,000 other homes in the Santa Rosa area. But I'm telling you, I'm here to testify that this ecological event that's occurring off our coast is worse. It's worse than the fire that burned down all our property and our belongings. I don't know how else to express this. So I'm asking the OPC to do everything that you can to expedite and to protect what we have, to rescue the seed stock, to replenish the kelp, to take away the red tape so that we divers can actually come out and do something. We want to save the seed stock. I think I've sent some pictures out. Maybe you haven't seen these, but it's a very dooming picture because it shows two abalone that's barely alive, surrounded by dead abalone and thousands of just completely surrounded by urchins. They will be dead by the end of the season. Many of us would like to go out and protect the resource and help out. There's a program. The people have put together a program, but we don't seem like we're heard. But we're encouraged by what OPC is doing. We encourage you to do more. This is war. The barbarians are at the gate. 5 years, we've seen this explosive, exponential death. We don't have a whole lot of time left before the fat lady sings, as they say. Mm. So we're asking the commission to please do everything you can. This is important to a lot of people.
Douglas, thank you. And thanks for taking time to be here and being so articulate on that. I think for a lot of us that don't have the experience you do, this is an invisible crisis because it's literally underwater. So thank you for giving it voice. And I think we should make sure that when we do have that discussion about the strategic plan, really we talk about how to address this present crisis, given the scale and urgency of the crisis and where that fits within our priorities. So appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you.
All right. Marin, I think I'm butchering your name, Erin.
Great.
That's great.
And then just so you know, followed by Marla Jo and Richard.
Hi there. My name is Maren Farnham. I'm an environmental scientist with the Executive Office at the State Lands Commission, also a former Sea Grant Fellow, should mention. And the State Lands Commission is part of the MPA statewide leadership team, and we act on behalf of the state as the landowner and property manager of the state's tidelands and submerged lands for state waters. And so we actually also issue leases to sister agencies like state parks that are part of the MPA network. We're very excited to participate today in the workshop earlier and be here today with you. I just wanted to tell you actually about a pilot project that we've done with the Port of San Diego. One of the new sort of resources that we've developed, it's a web mapping application, which is like an interactive spatial map, a tool that can be used. And we think it could really help with as a resource for MPA management and research. This tool combines data sets from across all different types of public trust uses. As you heard mentioned earlier, those are commerce, navigation, fisheries, recreation, and environmental stewardship. Right now, this pilot project just addresses the state waters offshore San Diego County, where we do have 11 different MPAs. You can access this application through www.sdoceanplanning.org. We entered into this partnership with the Port of San Diego. Also reached out to over 100 different ocean users and stakeholders to develop this project. So it's had a lot of public input, as well as input from environmental organizations, sister state, local, and federal agencies, the U.S. Navy, tribes, and many others, commercial fishing groups, and the MPA Collaborative Network. We would love to come back at another time when there is more time to show you a demonstration of this tool and also tell you about our plans to potentially move this pilot up the coast to other areas to serve for research needs, planning, help with planning questions, advance the work that you guys are doing here. So thank you for your time.
Thanks so much. And it sounds like we're going to be spending quality time all together in the strategic planning process. So I look forward to that. Mary Jo, Richard.
Hi, I'm Marla Jo Sadowski, Homefront Environmental Justice, Morro Bay. What I'm taking away today is that a piece of important piece of California's management for climate adaptation, climate mitigation, and ocean acidification, that it is a land-based problem as well as the ocean environment. We can study what's happening in the ocean. One of the most direct ways that the public can get on board and make the necessary safeguarding and resiliency challenges that are in front of us is through land use, development, and conservation issues. And I'd also like to, Mr. Blumenfeld, you suggested that the Coastal Commission and the Coastal Conservancy be at your workshop. I would like to request that the State Water Board be involved in this as well. On the coast, we have dilapidated sewer, like in my community, our sewage collections are so dilapidated that this new plant that they're building that I talked about before, the capacity is 1.32 for the sewer. 25% of that capacity is going to be gone because another partner is leaving. And yet they're designing this plant for 8.16 MG a day to accommodate inflow and infiltration through the dilapidated sewage collection pipes. We've tried to get that fixed. The regional board won't do a thing about it. It's also contaminating our drinking water aquifer. Now, all that stuff goes downhill to the ocean, to the beach, underground. So out of sight, out of mind, but it's there. And California needs to step up, and it's part of what we're doing for protecting our ocean. And that's how I see it. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Marla Jo. Richard.
Richard Sadowski, Homefront, EJ, Morro Bay. One of my, first of all, I get encouraged every time I come to the OPC. I do. You guys are awesome. You really are. And, you know, like the key thing, Ocean Science Trust, the key word is trust. We don't have that everywhere. I sat on the Planning Commission for 4 years. For 4 years, I was in contact with the Coastal Commission staff. In 2007, Citizen Science, okay? I was a wastewater collection system operator, first responder. We volunteered, we did reports. We finally got it proved that we have sewage entering our drinking water aquifer. And like the previous speaker said, the consultants, and this is in public meetings, they're saying that our sewage is self-sealing the pipes, and the infiltration is coming into the pipes, but nothing's leaching out. You can't have a logical conversation like that. This is what we've been dealing with for over 12 years now, okay? And like the gentleman before said, where you don't see out of sight, out of mind. We're in a liquefaction area. One of the things is that if the California is going to be a global leader, we can't have projects that are literally, I call them Rube Goldbergs. You can't pump crap all over the place and call it climate adaptation. Okay? What we have, one of my favorite people right now is Greta Thunberg. And she's a child. She speaks into the UN. Her key message, speak clearly. Say what you mean what you say. When we talk, we should be clear, okay? It shouldn't be wishy-washy. And I just feel that, you know, what we need to do is we need strong leadership, but we need the OPC to infiltrate that trust and build that trust with other agencies, particularly the Coastal Commission. My wife pounded on doors back in the day in Sacramento, Prop 20, to get that, to get the Coastal Commission established. And now they are taking a planning commission meeting and the local planning commission meeting, a city council meeting, a county planning commission meeting, a board of soup meeting. All those meetings are being taken out and consolidated in one meeting in June or July and fast-tracking this project. We have consultants that are made millions of dollars. And this is a disadvantage. We're a disadvantaged community. We have a huge disparity from income disparity. So please help us. We're in dire need.
Thank you, Richard. Jason Giffen, followed by Lily Sukiyama.
Good afternoon, members of the council. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Jason Giffen with the Port of San Diego, and I'm sad to say I'm not a Sea Grant fellow, but I know someone who knows a secret handshake. I know today you've already heard from a couple of my colleagues at the Port of San Diego, and over the years we've had opportunities to come before the council. This is our first opportunity to speak in front of the new Newsom administration, and we appreciate that opportunity. Just briefly today, I want to end the day on some high notes with a couple announcements. Just yesterday, May 22nd, was National Maritime Day, which is a day that pays special tribute to merchant marines and benefits of the maritime industry for our country. At the Port of San Diego, we celebrate Maritime Month throughout the entire month of May, not just one day, by offering free boat tours and bus tours of San Diego Bay and the working waterfront to highlight many of the valuable coastal dependent uses the Port of San Diego offers. Maritime Month is a great time for the port to showcase our working waterfront and its importance to the economy. And new this year, to the Maritime Month celebration, we've added a boat tour that will be narrated 100% in Spanish and will be co-hosted by one of our local radio stations. And this is particularly important around the topic of environmental justice and to make sure our portside communities are also included as a part of our tours. So if you happen to be in San Diego at the end of the month, we still have a tour. So if you're interested, please join us. I just want to briefly touch on some shared priorities. At the Port of San Diego, as you've heard, we also wear many hats. And that's where our responsibilities overlap with the Ocean Protection Council. Not only do we provide some of the connections for goods and freights and tourism, as you've already heard, but we have a vested interest in environmental quality, like water quality, both in San Diego Bay and our related watersheds. We, along with some local partners, have been leading our charge to improve water quality in places like the Tijuana River Valley. Additionally, switching gears briefly, we were one of the first ports to adopt a climate action plan in 2013, and soon the State Lands Commission will be submitting our sea level rise assessment report pursuant to AB 691. So we really appreciate the work with the Lieutenant Governor and the staff at State Lands. Just to wrap things up, I just want to conclude by saying and acknowledging many of the issues that we have common interest in together are incubated here at the Council, and we look forward to continuing to collaborate with both the old and the new members of the council as we move forward to manage our coast in a meaningful way and to provide public coastal access for all.
Thanks so much. Next, Lily, and then the last comment from Keith Rootser.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Lily Tsukuyama. I am a former Sea Grant Fellow, and I was not the one who taught Jason the secret handshake. I started out as a fellow working on the San Diego Ocean Planning Partnership with Marin, and so I just wanted to echo her comments about spreading the word about the web mapping application. But actually, what I'm here to talk to you about today is to give you an update on the port's integrated planning effort, known as the Port Master Plan Update, which is the port's first comprehensive update to our port master plan since it was certified by the Coastal Commission in 1981. We've been engaged in this effort since 2013, directed by our board and led by port staff such as Jason, as well as our director of planning, Leslie Nishihira. And just a few weeks ago, we released a full discussion draft of the updated port master plan for a 90-day public review period, which closes on July 31st, 2019. The draft includes site-specific standards that stretch from the Imperial Beach oceanfront, Coronado Bayfront, the Working Waterfront, and the Embarcadero, and it also includes San Diego Bay-wide policies in chapters that we call elements, and those include environmental justice, mobility, ecology, and safety and resiliency, all with the goal to enhance coastal and public access around San Diego Bay. The port is appreciative of the statewide work that the OPC has done for our coast and coordinated efforts between OPC and other state agencies. It was really helpful for us at the local level to be able to refer to consistent guidance from the state when drafting policies on topics related to environmental justice, protecting coastal resources, sea level rise, and promoting an established and emerging water-dependent businesses. So we encourage you and OPC staff to review this discussion draft during the 90-day window. We have a hard copy here that we'll leave with you today. And we've also brought informational four-pagers about the Port Master Plan update, as well as flyers that provide information about how to provide comment during the 90-day review period. And thank you for your time, and we look forward to continuing to develop meaningful collaboration between the Port and OPC. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Lily. And then finally, Keith.
Thank you very much for affording me the time to speak to the council. I'm a volunteer diver for Reef Check California, and I'm also on the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council. And as a Reef Check diver for the last 10 years, I've had a lot of opportunity to dive this whole state from San Diego all the way up into Mendocino. And for the first 5 years, like in 2009 when I started, it was really great. You know, California diving was great. But then starting in November of 2013, it all kind of took a nosedive. And in Monterey, we've seen just the kelp disappear and the urchins just kind of take over the whole place. And making this march from Point Pinos all the way down to into the breakwater in Monterey. And it's been kind of a slow march compared to the North Coast. North Coast is more linear. They just like lost everything, and the abalone fishery was a big impact of $44 million to that local economy. But in Monterey, you know, the tourism in Monterey is worth $2.85 billion with a B. So it's a big impact to that area. And you know, as a dive master on a boat, we used to tell the divers when they go out, we used to give them advice, like if you get stuck in kelp, what to do, like don't spin around like a fork in spaghetti, you know, because it's hard, you know, just like, or you can climb over it. But now we don't tell them anything because there's no reason you could just swim right around it. It's just so thin these days. So it's been, had a devastating impact to the local diving community. And we're under pressure too, because now those North Coast divers aren't going to the North Coast very much. They're coming to Monterey, and we're running out of dive sites in Monterey that are decent to look at. I talked to a lot of divers, and you know, people say if I were to start now, I wouldn't start diving. There are people that drop out of diving because it's just not any, it's not that interesting anymore. There's not that species that you see. And these areas, I mean, we can say it's anthropogenic. It's from climate change's causes. But, you know, we are obliged to, these areas are denuded of species. They're deparate. And we need to go in there and remove these urchins and restore the kelp back for a lot of reasons. Carbon sequestration, coastal beach erosion, that there's all kinds of reasons to do that. And sea otters are in our area, and they are a threatened species, and they need that habitat. So it's for saving sea otters, too. There's so many reasons for us to get in there and do that. But also in Monterey, is we have marine protected areas that ring that surround the entire peninsula. So it's a challenge for us to get permission to be able to do that. Right now, I'm working on an experiment with Reef Check California to, there's 20 rocks that are in this one area. We're going there, and we're manipulating the count on these rocks to determine what is the threshold density of when kelp will reestablish in those areas, with the hope that if we can figure out what that is, then we can move forward with it. But I also can say, too, that I know you have the guidelines, but we have a certain sense of urgency because we're working on it now. It's a project we're working on now. We want to be able to advance that for next year's activities too, and be funded for both of those projects. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Really helpful comment, and sort of a sobering note to end on, but one that that really underscores the urgency of the work that folks in this room do. So we are to the end of our meeting. I wanted to announce that our next regularly scheduled meeting will be held on August 14th here in Sacramento from 1 to 4 at the Natural Resources Building Auditorium, but that we are anticipating a public or a summit workshop on our strategic plan that is accessible to public, and we encourage folks to come and share their thoughts. Let me turn it to my colleagues for any last words before we adjourn. Is there a motion to adjourn? Seconded. All in favor? Aye. We are adjourned. Thank you. Wow, that does sound like a major crisis.